All rise. Superior Court for the Second Judicial District in Anchorage with the Honorable Paul Hilton presiding.
All right, please have a seat. Thank you. All right, so let's see. Back on record in the KIC versus Linda Knight and Walter Featherly matter. Same folks who were present in the morning. We have an additional person. If you want to introduce.
Your Honor, I'm Pierre Louis on behalf of KIC.
All right. Good afternoon to you. And same over here. Nope, we have one more, but I recognize you. So good to see you. Okay, Mr. Slarsky, or who is?
That'll be Mr. Pierre Louis.
Okay, great. And spell your last name for me, please.
P-I-E-R-R-E hyphen L-O-U-I-S.
Okay, great.
All right, Your Honor. May I begin?
Yes.
Wonderful. Good afternoon, Your Honor. Again, I'm Pierre Louis on behalf of KIC. Your Honor, this phase today concerns a single statutory determination. Under Alaska's punitive damages statute, punitive damages may be awarded if the court determines by clear and convincing evidence that defendant's conduct either was outrageous, including acts done with malice or bad motive, or evidenced with reckless indifference to the interests of another person. The statute is disjunctive. Punitive damages are permitted if defendant's conduct was outrageous or if it was evidenced by reckless indifference to the interests of another person. Therefore, the court's findings may rest in either prong, or both. But importantly, the court is not required to choose a single label for defendant's conduct. The inquiry, therefore, today is functional. It's not semantic. It's whether defendant's behavior crossed a line that Alaska law deems to warrant punishment or deterrence. KIC submits today, and as it has in its prior evidence, that the evidence here satisfies both prongs independently. And just to be clear about the legal standards that the court is applying today. Under Alaska law, a plaintiff must show at a minimum reckless indifference to the rights of others, in that it involved conscious action that was taken in deliberate disregard of those rights. That's the Chismar case. Importantly, what Alaska law does not require is a showing of actual malice. Therefore, there does not need to be ill will or hostility or bad intent. Reckless misconduct, Your Honor, is different from ordinary negligence. Negligence involves inadvertence or lack of skill. Recklessness requires something more, a conscious choice to pursue a course of action despite knowing the risk. In other words, the question is not whether defendants made mistakes. It's whether they knowingly chose a path that exposed their client or third persons to substantial risks and proceeded anyways. With that framework in mind, the evidence that the court has already seen shows a series of deliberate choices made with full awareness of the stakes and of the risks. That's the lens through which the court should view the conduct that we're about to walk through today. This action shows a course of conduct, not a single misstep. Across four phases, defendants repeatedly knew the risks of their client, knew that lawful alternatives were available, and chose strategies that increased the likelihood of serious harm. At the outset, the conduct was reckless, and as it progressed, it just became outrageous. The evidence that we'll walk through today is laid out in four chapters, which was designed to help the court assess at each stage what defendants knew, what options were available, and what they chose to do anyways. I call them chapters. Chapter one is going to focus at the outset of the representation. It shows that how defendants knowingly accepted an outcome determinative mandate, recognized the need for experienced M&A counsel, and then chose to proceed without that expertise. This chapter is going to establish reckless indifference at the outset. Chapter two is going to address how defendants conducted negotiations and after that initial choice was made. It shows how defendants handled valuation, limited disclosure, and pursued negotiation strategies that foreseeably undermined the transaction and deprived their client, KIC, of informed decision-making. Chapter 3 is going to outline what happened after negotiations had faltered. It walks through defendants' pivot to a strict foreclosure scheme, how that strategy was conceived, structured, executed, and why it was grossly disproportionate and rather coercive. And Chapter 4, finally, is going to cover defendants' conduct after the strict foreclosure scheme. It's going to show how defendants responded once the risk that they had created became unavoidable by escalating rather than mitigating harm and by shifting consequences of their strategy onto their client. taken together, these chapters are going to show a continuous conduct, course of conduct, one that's going to begin with reckless disregard and escalates into conduct that also satisfies the statute's outrageousness prong as outlined by the punitive damages statute. Your Honor, yesterday the court heard extensive evidence about what defendants did and what it cost KIC. Today the question is different. We're not relitigating damages. We're asking the court to evaluate what defendants, how defendants behaved, what they knew at the time, and what choices they made anyways, because those are the facts that matter for punitive damages. As outlined in the affidavit of KIC's president, Charles Lampe, which the court has already reviewed ad nauseum, KIC is based in Kaktovik, Alaska. It's a village up north of about 250 people, and it's located on the northern coast. It's actually one of the most remote communities in the country. Residents live a subsistence lifestyle. They hunt, they fish, and they rely on land and sea in ways that require extraordinary skill and resilience. This context matters, Your Honor, not to elicit sympathy for our clients, but to understand how KIC functions and how its leadership reasonably relies on professional advisors. KIC is governed by a board of directors that's composed of village shareholders. These are folks who volunteer their time to serve the interests of their community. They're not professionals. They're not professional corporate directors. They're not lawyers or bankers or engineers or financial experts. Their roles is to take care of village resources to maintain their culture, their way of life, not to independently design complex legal strategies or financial strategies. The board decides to rely on professional advisors, as the affidavit outlines, who explain risks to them, evaluate options, and recommend lawful courses of action. In 2013, Marsh Creek LLC was not a struggling venture. As the court has already heard, it was a mature, profitable enterprise that had generated millions of dollars to KIC and its shareholders. A licensed appraiser, as the court has already heard ad nauseum, had valued the business at more than $25 million. The evidence yesterday focused on that loss of value. Today, what we focus on is what defendants knew about the value and how they treated it. Following Marsh Creek's graduation from the SBA's 8A program, KIC faced a single central business problem. It needed to consider whether to acquire Solston's 49% interest and restructure Marsh Creek's assets in order to preserve value and grow the enterprise value. That acquisition was not one of many legal tasks. It was the task, and defendants understood that. The evidence that has already been before the court shows that defendants understood exactly what was at stake. They knew that failure to acquire Solston's interest would jeopardize Marsh Creek's value. They knew that delay and mismanagement would foreseeably cause substantial harm. And importantly, for our purposes today, these are not hindsight risks. These were front-end risks that were identified, that were discussed with KIC's board, and that was understood even before the acquisition began, or the acquisition efforts began. As a result, defendants were retained to do four things, which in our papers has been referred to as the M&A mandate. These four things were to evaluate the acquisition, to conduct evaluation and diligence, to negotiate and draft a purchase agreement, and close a transaction that would be necessary to preserve value. Defendants themselves defined that mandate and what they deemed an engagement letter that they unilaterally sent to KIC. They did not disclaim that mandate, they didn't narrow it, and they did not advise KIC that that task exceeded their capabilities.
Let me ask you, how does this M&A mandate compare to the letter that Mr. Featherly sent to KIC saying?
The letter at KICA enshrines that M&A mandate. It acknowledges that Mr. Featherly and his team was going to be retained to conduct that eventual acquisition.
I guess I'm specifically focusing on preserve enterprise value.
Well, one of the terms of KIC 8 was that they were retained to conduct evaluation and diligence. And so the actions that ensued, including the valuation, were just like a natural extension of that.
Okay, go ahead.
So a reasonable, prudent attorney that was going to undertake that mandate, especially particularly given the stakes, would do several basic things. They would substantially involve experienced M&A counsel, they would run an organized deal process, and they would give candid advice about risk, costs, and alternatives. That's just baseline professional practice. Defendants, as we just talked about, represented that they could do this work. At the outset, they held themselves out as capable of managing the acquisition, any issues that would arise, the negotiations, and the closing. Of course, Holland & Knight, being one of the biggest firms in the world, has the ample sophistication necessary to conduct this engagement properly. That representation to KIC matters because reckless indifference would include taking on a role while disregarding the foreseeable consequences of doing that badly. At the outset, defendants themselves recognized that there was a problem. They knew that Mr. Featherly did not have the experience necessary to handle transactions of this size and complexity. And the records show, as the court has already seen, that he acknowledges explicitly. In KIC 6, it's a June 25, 2014 email that the court has already looked at yesterday from Mr. Featherly to Mark Von Bergen, the Holland & Knight M&A partner, that in which Mr. Featherly writes, Sarah Curtis and I are working on a matter that we could use your help with, and our client wishes to acquire its interest and a partner. That email that the court has reviewed matters for a very simple reason. It shows contemporaneous recognition, especially by defendants themselves, that this was not routine work and that experienced M&A counsel would be required. And defendants didn't just acknowledge that internally, they conveyed that to KIC. When the court turns to KIC 10, the court has already reviewed the notes from KIC's July 1st, 2014 board meeting, in which Mr. Mark Van Bergen was introduced to the board as a senior member of the Holland & Knight team with the transaction expertise necessary to handle that acquisition. So at that point, everyone is aligned. Defendants knew that M&A expertise was needed. They identify the right person, and they present that person to the board as the solution. What matters for our purposes today is what happens next, is because despite knowing and acknowledging this need for expertise, and despite holding it out to the board, defendants immediately stopped using it. It's one of the first inflection points for punitive purposes in this case. The M&A partner was sidelined. Mr. Featherly assumed control of the acquisition effort, and no experienced M&A lawyer was meaningfully involved going forward. That conclusion is not based on hindsight. It's based on contemporaneous record, including some of the evidence we handed Your Honor earlier, and it's confirmed by expert analysis. You've already seen the documents that show that M&A expertise was identified, requested, and presented to the board. But when the court turns to Mr. Holden Stein's expert report, Mr. Stein explains what happens next. He concludes that after Holland & Knight was engaged, that no M&A attorneys were substantially involved in the deal or the related acquisition efforts. And defendants' own billing records actually tell the same story. After the issue we raised yesterday, we went back and excerpted all of Mr. Van Bergen's billing records, which have been presented to Your Honor as KIC 196. And they're summarized in a spreadsheet. And those billing records reflect that Mr. Von Bergen, the M&A partner introduced to the board, played no significant role in the acquisition after that initial introduction. As my colleague, Mr. Slarsky, noted yesterday, the billing records in front of you, Your Honor, make clear that Mark Von Bergen, I think across two or three pages, his involvement totaled approximately 20 billable hours over a five-year period, which is spread roughly evenly from year to year. That matters for a very, very, a three-year period. That matters for a very simple reason. That's not oversight. It's not some short-term staffing gap, and it was not a misunderstanding about roles. Defendants knew that M&A expertise was required. They had access to it. They told the board they would use it, and they chose not to use it. For our purposes today, this decision is critical because it marks the point where defendants consciously proceeded without the professional safeguards necessary that they themselves had identified as necessary. Proceeding without the necessary expertise while continuing to hold themselves as capable was reckless indifference. There was, as a result, no organized or disciplined deal process of the sort that one would expect of an acquisition of this size, and there was no meaningful deployment of the transaction expertise that defendants represented they would provide. We're not revisiting this evidence to relitigate liability, right, or to argue that this deal should have closed. We're offering it for a different purpose in this phase, to show defendants a state of mind and the critical decisions that were made. The record shows that defendants knew and understood what was at stake. They knew what competent practice required and nonetheless chose to proceed without the professional safeguards necessary. It was a conscious decision to move forward down a path that that absolutely dispensed with basic protections at the outset. If the court were to stop right here, before valuation concealment, before the foreclosure strategy, and before the arbitration, the record already satisfies the reckless indifference prong of Alaska's punitive damages statute. This chapter showed that at the onset, defendants knew what was at stake, what competent practice required, and willingly and chose to proceed without it. That conduct alone, we submit, would satisfy the reckless indifference standard. But there was more. Chapter 2 is going to address what defendants did after they assumed control of the acquisition process. This chapter is going to focus on how defendants conducted negotiations, how valuation was handled, what information was withheld, and how those decisions shaped a strategy that predictably undermined the very transaction that they were hired to complete. By the time negotiations were underway, several things were already true, Your Honor. As defendants effectively assumed control of the acquisition process, M&A counsel, as I said earlier, was no longer meaningfully involved. But also additionally, defendants were not just solely acting as legal advisors, Your Honor. They were directing the KIC board on valuation, on leverage, and on deal strategy. With that role came responsibility, not just for legal compliance, but also the integrity of the negotiation process itself. As the court already seen, objective valuation evidence was available early, and it remained to defendants, and it remained available throughout this process. In June 2013, at Mr. Featherly's own recommendation, KIC paid for a business appraisal of Marsh Creek by a licensed appraiser, Mr. Scott Gapehart. That recommendation was reflected in the email that the court reviewed yesterday, and it was completed and delivered in October of 2013. KIC-4, as the court has already reviewed, is the appraisal report itself. And to briefly orient the court to two pages of that report that the court has already reviewed yesterday, at page 13 of KIC-4, that appraisal sets out the full enterprise value of Marsh Creek, $25,228,000. And at page 29 of KIC-4, that appraisal applies the valuation of Solston's 49% minority interest, valuing that interest, the interest that KIC intended to acquire, as between $9.7 million and $12.5 million, depending on the discounts that my colleague outlined yesterday. These numbers, Your Honor, are important because these numbers are important, but what matters more is what they represent. This was not an estimate. It was not a negotiating position. It was a licensed professional valuation that was prepared for the purpose of guiding this acquisition. And it wasn't a one-off valuation. The Gapehart valuation was updated again, as the court saw, in June 2015, which is KIC 19. And that updated appraisal reaffirmed the same basic conclusion, that Marsh Creek had substantial enterprise value. And also that Solston's minority interest could be acquired at fair market value.
Say that last part.
That Solston's minority interest could be acquired at fair market value. And so by 2015, defendants had not one but two independent appraisals prepared years apart, reaching consistent conclusions about value. The significance here, Your Honor, is not that these appraisals existed, but what defendants did once they had them. They chose to sideline and conceal valuation evidence and pursue a strategy that would be grounded in unreliable figures that foreseeably distorted negotiations and increased the risk to the client, KIC. The record shows that defendants...
Did KIC have an obligation to share the appraisal with Solston?
The idea is yes, because of the fact that it's their minority, it's an appraisal about the value of a joint venture that's governed by an operating agreement between the parties, and an operating agreement that generally requires the parties to act in good faith amongst one another. And
did the operating agreement control this sale?
The sale of...
Of KSE purchasing Solston?
I mean, the operating agreement outlines the responsibilities of the parties vis-a-vis each other.
Sure, sure.
And given the fact that it also has options for for triggering valuations of price or determinations of the price of Marsh Creek, I'd argue that, yes, the operating
agreement. Something to follow. It's not necessarily right. required.
Absolutely. But then again, that's when we enter into the fiduciary duties of the parties. The record also reflects that defendants knew exactly and understood exactly what the appraisals meant at that time. If the court turns to KIC 33, it's an internal email from Sarah Curtis, an attorney at Holland & Knight, after receiving a draft valuation from the appraiser, Mr. Gabehart. In that email, Ms. Curtis writes to Mr. Featherly and other Holland & Knight lawyers that they received the draft valuation back from the appraisers. I'm paraphrasing for sake of time. Please take a look. It came in much higher than expected. We may be able to revisit some of the items before final. That email is important, among other things, because it captures defendants' understanding and intent in real time. The valuation of Marsh Creek was higher than their own, arbitrary sense, in that they intended to subvert the license appraisal process to obtain a below market value negotiating point. For purposes today, that point is critical. It's that defendants knew and understood that the license appraisal value could point to a higher fair market value, and they deliberately intended to undermine that appraisal value. Rather than negotiating from the appraised values, defendants withheld the appraisals from Solston and substituted their own numbers, figures that they themselves called their, quote, rough calculations. Those internally generated figures were then used as valuation anchors in those negotiations. And the record shows how this unfolded. In one email at KIC 17 at page 66, defendants shared their rough calculation with Solston as a basis for valuation discussions. At or near the same time, defendants reached out to BDO, the auditing firm, asking for BDO's underlying spreadsheet so that defendants could run their own calculations, which the court can find at KIC 17 at page 94. Further, at KIC 17 at 95, which is excerpted for the court in the binder, BDO responded by cautioning defendants directly. BDO made clear that defendants should not be presenting their own valuations as if they reflected BDO's valuation work, and warned against passing off those numbers without additional clarification. So even BDO, the third-party auditor, recognized the problem. Again, defendants' conduct was not inadvertent or the result of confusion. It was a deliberate response to license valuation evidence that defendants simply did not want to use in negotiations. Defendants then simply declined to produce documents in the ordinary course of negotiations. The evidence shows that defendants affirmatively advised KIC to withhold valuation and financial information as a negotiating strategy. That advice appears repeatedly on the record. In one instance at KIC 13, Mr. Featherly directed members of KIC's board not to disclose valuation materials or other financial information in response to Solsted's request. In another evidence at KIC 36, Mr. Featherly instructed Marsh Creek officers not to respond at all to Solsted's demand for financial information. And in another, a Holland & Knight attorney prepared an email for KIC's then-president, Philip Tickluck, instructing him to, quote, cut and paste the language into a message back to Solston, effectively scripting the non-disclosure response.
Which one was that one?
This is KIC 39. This was not passive non-disclosure or single miscommunication. Defendants' advice was to restrict the flow of information, and that was deliberate and sustained, to shape negotiations and how they were conducted over time, and repeatedly discouraging disclosure of licensed appraised materials that would have allowed Solston, the joint venture partner, to evaluate the transaction on an informed basis. It wasn't a momentary lapse in judgment, but a conscious strategy that departed from transparent, good faith deal practices, and that foreseeably distorted the bargaining process to the detriment of KIC. For purposes of punitive damages, the issue here, Your Honor, is not whether or not lawyers are permitted to advocate on behalf of their clients aggressively. Of course they are. The question is whether defendants knowingly replaced objective valuation evidence with figures they had been told was unreliable, and then used those figures in a way that foreseeably distorted negotiations and increased the risk that the transaction would fail. That's what the record before Your Honor shows. And the effect of those decisions was predictable. As negotiations progressed, Solston repeatedly asked for valuation information so that it could evaluate the proposals that Your Honor had seen recently and participate meaningfully in those discussions. Defendants advised KIC not to provide that information. Over time, that approach that defendants devised eroded the trust amongst the joint venture partners. Negotiations became increasingly strained and adversarial, not because the parties' interests were irreconcilable, but because one side was being asked to negotiate based on arbitrary representations and without access to basic valuation information. That progression, Your Honor, was neither sudden nor surprising. It was the foreseeable result of a negotiation strategy devised by defendants that was premised on withholding information rather than engaging transparently. For our purposes today, that causal chain matters because the breakdown of the relationship was not the result or the product of bad luck or some unavoidable business disagreement. It flowed directly from choices defendants had made, despite the warnings, despite available alternatives, and despite knowing that the strategy they were pursuing increased the likelihood of collapse of negotiations rather than resolution. Strikingly, Your Honor, even as negotiations became more strained, Solston did not walk away from the deal. Instead, Solston made multiple concrete offers to sell its interests, each one of those below the licensed appraised value of approximately $9.7 million. It even offered to purchase KIC's interest entirely if KIC would have preferred that exit. As KIC 29 shows, in August 2015, Solston offered to sell its 49% interest for $6.25 million, plus a 1.75% of gross revenues, or alternatively, a lump sum payment of $9.5 million, which is below the appraised value on the low end. And when negotiations continued, Solston even reduced his asking price further. KIC 31 shows the September 4th email where Solston, or the September 4th document, where Solston offered to sell for $5.95 million in cash plus $1.625 of gross income, or a lump sum of $8.75 million, again, below the appraised value. Throughout that period, however, defendants were actively advising KIC's board and assisting in evaluating Solston's proposal. And despite that role, defendants recommended rejecting each of those offers. The point here, Your Honor, is not whether any of those offers should have been accepted. It's what these offers demonstrate, that even in the backdrop of deteriorating negotiations and growing distrust, Solston was still willing to transact. These were not aspirational demands or obstructionist positions. They were concrete, below appraisal offers that were structured to facilitate a closing. For our purposes, these matter because these offers confirm that lawful, value-preserving alternatives remained available. And at precisely that moment, defendants advised against them and continued down a path that increased the risk of collapse rather than resolution. Defendants' conduct evidences a reckless indifference to KIC's interests. They knew their approach was undermining negotiations. They knew that disclosure in a competent deal process could reduce that risk, and they chose instead to continue with a strategy that foreseeably put both the transaction and the enterprise at risk. This chapter shows more than just recklessness carried forward. Defendants simply failed to course correct. They affirmatively concealed evidence, substituted figures, and advised a negotiation strategy that distorted from the bargaining process itself. At that stage, that's the point in which the conduct just departs from ordinary advocacy. At that stage, defendants chose to double down. They chose to withhold information and move away from negotiations altogether. Chapter 3, which we'll talk about, is going to address what they did next. Defendants suggest that Mr. Featherly simply made a mistake, right? But the record does not support that characterization. What the evidence shows is not a single error or momentary lapse, but a series of deliberate choices that were made over time in the face of contrary information and available alternatives that consistently increased the risk to the client. Mistakes happen, Your Honor, but what happened here was persistence. Mr. Featherly was warned, presented with objective valuation evidence, and given multiple opportunities to recalibrate and course correct, but he just simply chose not to. Next, we're going to talk about defendants' conduct when negotiations became fraught. Or we're going to talk about defendants' conduct the strategy they adopted in response, and how that strategy marked a decisive escalation from reckless indifference into conduct that would even independently satisfy the statute's outrageousness prong. The court has already seen what this strategy has cost KIC. Today, we're going to focus on why defendants chose it, what they knew when they chose this strategy, and why that choice matters under Alaska law. When negotiations became difficult, defendants were not operating in a vacuum. They knew the acquisition had not yet closed, they knew the joint venture relationship had deteriorated, and they knew that based on valuation evidence that was already discussed, that Marsh Creek still remained a valuable enterprise. Critically, they also knew that failure of negotiations didn't eliminate lawful options. It created a moment that should have required reassessment. They could have renewed negotiations that would be grounded in full disclosure. They could have explored various separation or restructuring strategies that could have been designed to preserve value. They could have advised KIC of the heightened risk and counseled caution. And none of those options would have entailed coercion. None of these would have required a seizure of assets. All would have involved some risk, but those risks would have been manageable and lawful. Having failed to accomplish the acquisition through negotiation, defendants didn't advise in a different transactional structure or recommend a pause to reassess the risk and recalibrate. No, instead they made a consequential choice. They abandoned the objective of pursuing Sultan's interests altogether and then pivoted to an enforcement strategy that would be designed to obtain control of the enterprise without paying fair market value at all. The evidence shows that the strict foreclosure strategy was not conceived as some sort of a last resort remedy to address some unexpected default. It was a substitute for the failed acquisition, a means of accomplishing through enforcement what defendants had been unable to accomplish through their negotiations as a failure of their own strategies. That distinction is critical for our purposes because it goes directly to the intent. That's not reactive lawyering. It was strategic design. You've heard plenty already about the strict foreclosure scene, but I'll just go through it again briefly. By 2017, when negotiations became increasingly strained, defendants pivoted away from any effort to reach a deal with Solston and instead developed a plan to eliminate Solston entirely from the joint venture. It wasn't a subtle plan. They advised that KIC extend a series of insider loans to Marsh Creek. Those loans were not arm's-length loans from an independent lender. They were loans that were structured by KIC's own lawyers at Holland & Knight between affiliated parties with the express purpose of positioning KIC as a secured creditor with sweeping enforcement rights. From the outset, the loans were designed less as a means of repayment and more as a mechanism through which control would ultimately be attained. In the provisions, the loan agreements that defendants drafted themselves secured the debt with substantially all of Marsh Creek's valuable assets. In each of those promissory notes that governed the strict foreclosure had default provisions that were strict. Cure opportunities were limited, enforcement remedies were emphasized, and the agreements were written to make sure that foreclosure would be swift and decisive. Defendants knew exactly what they were doing. Based on the Gabe Hart appraisal that they obtained themselves, they knew that Marsh Creek was worth $25 million or north of that. They knew that the loan amounts would only be a fraction of that value. Collateralizing the entire enterprise to secure a relatively modest debt ensured that any enforcement would be grossly disproportionate in its effect. And also critically, Your Honor, default was not treated as a mere possibility. The documentary record that Your Honor has already reviewed shows that defendants intended Marsh Creek to default when the loans were structured. Default was intended, enforcement was intended, foreclosure was intended, all before any payment was missed by Marsh Creek. At the time, KIC understood, based on defendants' advice, that these transactions could be commercially reasonable and consistent with KIC's duties. What KIC was not told is equally important. As we outline in our complaint, another Holland & Knight partner, George Gregoris, warned Mr. Featherly in writing that this strict foreclosure would be, quote, quite problematic. He warned that the value of Marsh Creek's assets far exceeded the debt, that pursuing foreclosure would expose KIC to litigation from Solston, And specifically, to quote Mr. Gregoris' email, as my colleague did yesterday, which is at KIC 92, the, quote, somewhat stated objective of stripping Solson's 49% would be problematic. Mr. Gregoris also noted and warned that there was a real risk of litigation if Solson had the wherewithal to proceed that way. Those warnings were never disclosed to KIC. They were never discussed with the board, and despite them, Mr. Featherly still pressed forward. In the late fall of 2017, at defendants' direction, Marsh Creek executives affiliated with KIC intentionally defaulted on the loans by failing to make payments of only a few thousand dollars. In March 2018, defendants then advised KIC to declare a default, refuse Solston's offer to cure that default, and proceed with a strict foreclosure on all of Marsh Creek's valuable assets. Those assets were then transferred, again at defendants' direction, into a series of newly created subsidiary entities that Holland and Knight advised KIC to form. Defendants assured KIC that these new entities could independently qualify for the 8A program, that they could take over Marsh Creek's contract and position KIC to re-enter 8A contracting with 100% ownership of the business and assets. What defendants did not advise was that the foreclosure itself, the financial history of the new entities, and the inability to easily novate contracts would all pose serious, if not fatal, barriers to re-entry in the 8A program. In short, the strategy that defendants sold to KIC was doomed from the start, and it was pursued anyways. And to this day, as Your Honor saw yesterday from Mr. Featherly's deposition transcript, he refuses to acknowledge the arbitrator's finding of wrongdoing, of his wrongdoing. The effect on Solston, the minority partner, was immediate and it was devastating. Solston held a 49% equity interest in an enterprise that was worth approximately $25 million, an interest that was appraised on the low end at $9.8 million. And through strict foreclosure, that equity interest was extinguished entirely. Solston received no compensation for its ownership stake. Its interest was wiped out through enforcement of insider debt that defendants had deliberately structured. That outcome was not incidental. It was the intended result of the strategy that defendants had devised. The foreclosure accomplished exactly what the negotiations had failed to achieve: unilateral control of the enterprise and elimination of Solson's equity interest without payment of fair market value. For our purposes, this matters because it demonstrates that harm to another party's interests, along with the attendant legal and fiduciary exposure to KIC, was not merely foreseeable, it was intrinsic to the plan. And when they found out, defendants didn't desist from their improper plan. They did not disclose the warnings to KIC. They didn't recommend alternative enforcement strategies or other mechanisms or mitigation strategies. They proceeded with the foreclosure exactly how it was designed. For purposes of our hearing today, this sequence of events is critical. The strict foreclosure was not a good faith attempt to collect on a debt. It was a planned, disproportionate, and coercive strategy designed to seize enterprise value through a legal formality. Executing and advising on such a scheme, knowing the disparity, knowing the risk, and knowing the fiduciary implications, constitutes both recklessness to the client's interest and outrageousness under the punitive damages statute. At this point, Your Honor, I want to be very clear, as we said already in the pre-hearing conference that we had, about what we're not asking the court to do. We're not asking the court to decide that defendants committed a crime. This is not the court's role today, and it's not necessary for this phase. What matters for this phase is what defendants knew, what risks were objectively apparent to them, and whether proceeding in face of those risks was reckless indifference or was outrageous conduct under the statute. That's where the expert evidence that we presented, that has been the subject of a lot of conversation already, becomes important. KIC retained an expert who has substantial experience evaluating and prosecuting complex financial misconduct, Mr. Tim Patuminis, who's a former prosecutor, who also has experience prosecuting schemes involving insider transactions and misuse of collateral. After reviewing the loan documents, the default mechanics, the foreclosure, and the surrounding communications, the expert reached a clear conclusion. The expert concluded that the foreclosure strategy that defendants designed and implemented tracked the elements of multiple criminal offenses, including scheme to defraud, theft by deception, and misapplication of property. Again, Your Honor, that is not being offered to suggest criminal liability in this proceeding. It's offered to show how extreme and how aberrational this conduct was when measured against ordinary legal and commercial practice. The expert's analysis focused on several features of the strategy that are really hard to explain as good faith lawyering. First, that the loans were structured between affiliate parties, not at arm's length, and secured by collateral worth way more than the debt. Second, that default was anticipated at the outset and not treated as a mere contingency. And third, that enforcement was pursued in a way that stripped the joint venture partner of its interest without any meaningful opportunity to cure and without proportionality to the debt. Those characteristics are significant because they are the same features that in other contexts would trigger legal scrutiny and potential criminal exposure. They're red flags, Your Honor, not gray areas. And more critically, this assessment aligns exactly with what defendants' own colleague had told them at the time. As I said earlier, H&K partner George Gregoris, who warned Mr. Featherly and other H&K lawyers before the foreclosure even occurred, that the strategy was problematic, that the value disparity was severe, and that litigation exposure was likely if Solson had the wherewithal. So when defendants chose to proceed, they weren't operating under uncertainty. They were aware of the risk. They were moving forward with a strategy that an experienced expert has now concluded bore the hallmarks of conduct that outside that in another context could be viewed as criminal. At this point, Your Honor, there is one thing that has to be said plainly. These were not business people in a gray market. These were not unsophisticated actors that were testing the edges of commercial practice. These were lawyers. These were officers of the court bound by professional rules that exist precisely because clients place extraordinary trust in lawyers. Trust that lawyers are not going to use their legal knowledge to exploit loopholes or manipulate processes or appropriate property under the guise of advocacy. The expert testimony of Mr. Patuminis matters because it shows just how far outside these bounds the defendants' conduct went. The foreclosure strategy was not just merely aggressive or even creative. It bore the hallmarks of conduct that in any other context could raise serious questions about criminality, misapplication of property, deception, and even abuse of insider control. And that matters more, not less, because of the fact that defendants were lawyers. Lawyers are not permitted to do indirectly what they can't do directly. They're not permitted to design transactions that strip a partner of millions in value by engineering a default or foreclosure while assuring their client that the conduct is lawful. It's not a case about a lawyer that got too close to the line. That's a case about lawyers crossing the line and then continuing to apply the rules that govern our profession. Punitive damages exist exactly for this reason, to condemn conduct that represents an abuse of professional power and a betrayal of the trust that the legal system places in its own officers. The last chapter is going to focus on defendants' conduct after the strict foreclosure was executed. By this point, the consequences of defendants' strategy was not just hypothetical anymore. The foreclosure occurred, Solson's equity interest had been wiped, and legal challenge was all but inevitable. After the foreclosure, there were several things that were immediately apparent. Solson disputed the legality of the foreclosure. The disparity between the debt and the value of the assets seized was obvious to everyone, And defendants knew, based on the warnings that they had already received, that the strategy they had pursued was legally vulnerable. At that point, they were no longer operating in a gray area. The likelihood of litigation and of adverse findings against their client, KIC, was no longer speculative. Therefore, they were faced with another set of choices. They could have advised disclosure of internal concerns to the client, KIC. They could have recommended unwinding or mitigating the foreclosure. They could have explored other means of limiting the exposure to the client. Each of those options would have required some sort of acknowledgement of the risk that defendants had themselves created. None of them would have been easy, but all of them were available to defendants. But again, they chose a different course. Rather than mitigating risk, they advised escalation further. Rather than candid exposure, they advised continued defense of their failed foreclosure strategy. And rather than narrowing exposure to KIC, they positioned the dispute for adjudication on the very strategy they had designed. It wasn't a neutral choice. It predictably increased the magnitude of harm. Defendants advised KIC to initiate arbitration against Solston. That decision placed a strict foreclosure squarely before a fact finder and invited counterclaims challenging the legality of the foreclosure itself. That's exactly what happened, and it's still continuing to this day. For our purposes today, the relevance of their decision is not that arbitration is improper. It's that defendants chose to escalate the dispute in a manner that exposed their client, KIC, to precisely the risk that defendants had been warned about and anticipated internally. As Your Honor has seen, internal memoranda that was prepared by defendants reflected that they understood the danger, that these were not abstract legal concerns. These were concrete assessments of probable outcomes. But despite recognizing those risks internally, defendants did not fully disclose them to KIC. They did not advise that the foreclosure strategy was likely to be deemed improper. They didn't recommend a corrective course of conduct or advise that this strategy would expose KIC to catastrophic liability. KIC therefore proceeded without the benefit of candid advice at the moment when it mattered the most. As anticipated, Solston asserted counterclaims that challenged the foreclosure. The foreclosure strategy became a central issue of arbitration and proceeds to this day. And the arbitrator ultimately found that foreclosure was, quote, a sham and that fiduciary duties had been breached, as at KIC 175. And those findings align precisely with what defendants had identified internally and chosen not to disclose to KIC. The consequences of the arbitrator's findings were severe for KIC. KIC was subjected to substantial damage, reputational harm, and years of litigation arising exactly from the foreclosure strategy that defendants had designed and that they had escalated. For our purposes in this part of the hearing, the key point is not the amount of the award, but the fact that the harm flows directly from choices that defendants made with full knowledge of the risk. Throughout this phase, the allocation of risk to the defendants was entirely one-sided. Your Honor, defendants continued to defend the strategy they had created. KIC, however, bore all of the legal and all of the financial consequences. Defendants didn't absorb, they didn't disclose, or they didn't meaningfully mitigate the risk they imposed. That imbalance underscores why this conduct matters under the punitive statute. Proceeding in the face of known probable harm, while withholding internal assessments and escalating exposure, should be found to be reckless indifference to the client's interests. The lawyers on this side were no longer guessing. They were proceeding despite knowing the likely outcome. Your Honor, if I may, I want to use the rest of my time to address some of the arguments that defendants made in their hearing briefs. And defendants' arguments on punitives follow a familiar structure. They ask the court to abstract the law away from the facts, to recharacterize the sustained course of conduct as some sort of isolated judgment call, and to treat foreseeability as hindsight. That strategy should not survive the record that the court has already seen. On page 29 of their trial brief, defendants began by emphasizing that punitive damages are disfavored and extraordinary. We don't dispute, KIC does not dispute that punitive damages are extraordinary. But Alaska law does not make them unavailable. It makes them conditional on clear and convincing evidence of either outrageous conduct or reckless indifference. The extraordinary nature of the remedy, Your Honor, does not lower the evidentiary burden. It simply explains why the court has to examine that conduct closely. The examination is happening right now, and it has already begun. The question isn't whether punitive damages are exceptional in the abstract, but whether the record before Your Honor satisfies the statutory standard, and we submit that it does. On page 57 of their trial brief, defendants argue that punitive damages are not presumed following a default. Plaintiff agrees. Punitive damages are not presumed, and plaintiff has not relied on any semblance of presumption. Instead, plaintiff is presenting a detailed evidentiary record that demonstrates exactly what defendants did, what they knew at the time, and how they chose to proceed anyway. It's not a punitive award resting on default. It's a punitive determination that's resting on evidence. At the end of their trial brief, they submit what the honor has seen that they called a summary chart. And on page 2 of their summary chart, and ad nauseum in their papers, defendants repeatedly assert that this case involves at most negligence or errors in professional judgment. This argument should collapse under the chronology that the court has already seen. Ordinary negligence, which we outlined at the beginning of our presentation, does not involve knowingly dispensing with basic professional guardrails. Ordinary negligence does not involve concealing evidence as a strategy. It does not involve engineering a foreclosure strategy that's designed to seize enterprise value and through a default. And most critically, ordinary negligence does not involve proceeding in the face of explicit warnings that the chosen course of action is legally problematic and disproportionate. This case, is, as I said earlier, is not about a bad call. It's about a series of deliberate choices made with knowledge of risk. Finally, one of their overarching arguments is that KIC approved of the strategy. They argue that KIC approved of the foreclosure strategy, among other things, and therefore assumed the risk. That argument fails both factually and legally, and it misunderstands the nature of the relationship between KIC and its lawyers. KIC, as I said earlier, is not a hedge fund or some private equity firm. It's a village corporation from Kaktovik, Alaska, a community of 250 people who are living in a rural lifestyle in one of the most remote regions in the world. KIC's board is composed of shareholders who are regular folks who volunteer their time. There are no lawyers on the board, no bankers, no engineers, no business professionals. They're sophisticated in the world of survival, not secured, complex secured lending law. As Mr. Lampe's affidavit explains, the KIC board relies on their advisors. That reliance is not incidental, it's foundational to how they inform their decision making. So KIC's board does not independently design complex legal strategies. It's not second guessing the technical advice given by their lawyers. It's not naivete on behalf of KIC's board. It's how the professional relationship is supposed to work. That contrast matters to their argument. Defendants are sophisticated professionals. They're attorneys that are educated at elite institutions that are advertising and marketing their expertise in native corporation law. As the court is well aware from reviewing fee applications in this case, are charging rates that signal not just experience, but superior judgment and specialized expertise. Charging rates of that magnitude sends a clear signal to KIC's board, especially a village corporation's board. It sends a signal that we have the skills, we have the education, and we have the judgment necessary to guide you through your complex and risky business transactions and decisions. When a board like KIC sees advice that's presented by high-priced lawyers at Holland & Knight, their expectation is not to independently reconstruct the legal analysis or their legal judgment. The expectation is that counsel, to the extent that counsel communicates with the board, has already done the work. The record contains no evidence at all whatsoever that that defendants provided KIC's board with clear and written explanation of the extraordinary risk of strict foreclosure, the gross disparity between the loan amount and the value of the assets that were at stake, the likelihood of fiduciary duty claims, and the probability that the strategy would be deemed improper or later challenged. There was no memorandum laying out alternatives. There was no structured presentation of options, no delineation of some sort of worst-case outcome. And critically, no disclosure of the internal warnings that defendants had received themselves. So advising a vulnerable, non-expert board to proceed with a coercive strategy without explaining its true risk and withholding internal warnings, it does not negate recklessness, it underscores it. All in all, Your Honor, KIC began this presentation by noting that this case is not about a single mistake or a difficult business decision that was made in good faith. It's about a sustained course of conduct that defendants knowingly abandoned professional safeguards, concealed material information, engineered a coercive foreclosure scheme, and escalated risk despite explicit warnings and foreseeable harm. That conduct satisfies both prongs of Alaska's punitive damages statute by clear and convincing evidence. KIC is therefore respectively asking the court to proceed and permit punitive damages and proceed to the second phase to determine an appropriate amount, an amount that reflects the seriousness of defendants' conduct and serves the punitive damages statute's purpose of punishment and deterrence. I'm happy to answer any questions that the court may have.
Sure. Tell me how Mr. Featherly communicated with the board typically. Was it emails? Was it letter?
So KIC didn't have email up until a certain time. And so, but at most points, they communicated via email. And the way that the communication would occur is it's usually around, like, board meetings happening. And usually a lot of the record reflects that Mr. Featherly would kind of just send predetermined, pre-finalized, like, packages and board resolutions over to KIC's board to help them set up a board meeting if any board write-off is required. So it was up until, I think, mid-2015 or so. I know they were late to it. It was after that, it was definitely email. Before, there were some communications. The bulk of the communication was via email, at least the ones that we've presented and the ones that we have.
And with regard to advising the board about risk or not, where have you seen that discussion take place, in emails or formal letters? I know that Ms. Curtis did at least one letter to the board.
In terms of advising the board about risk? Right. Well, I mean, part of our argument is the dearth of emails that outline, or at least the ones that I've drafted that would advise the client of, here's what happens if you proceed with this and if you proceed with that. And if anything, we don't have to go too far because HNK's own lawyers, when they were deposed, especially the transcript of Mr. Featherly, I'm happy to give you a cite, Rob Masulich, they don't recall ever communicating with KIC's board or outlining formal memos that would explain, like, risk and outcomes of certain decisions. And so I hate to answer Your Honor's question in a negative, but that's what we have not seen documents that we could construe as outlining, you know, risks and pitfalls of going forward with a specific decision.
How about other HNK lawyers? I know Ms. Curtis did at least one memo to the board.
Right.
Were there others, or did she have others other than the one that I've seen?
The ones that I've seen mostly have been board. One of the issues that we're here today is that board interactions have been primarily funneled to Mr. Featherly. Ms. Curtis is actually one of the only ones that I've seen been able to, like, email the board directly, which is, I think, one of the emails that Your Honor has seen. So I haven't seen other HNK lawyers communicate directly with the board, which is part of our contention at the outset. We have communications funneling legal research and other like, legal minutia over to Walter Featherly, but communications were funneled primarily through him. He was the relationship.
And then with regard to the notes, the minutes, I mentioned one, we talked about one yesterday, and there were two items. One was regarding business with Solston and or an offer, mm-hmm. And then the next one was about a high school wanting $500.
Yeah.
But it looks like the meeting was over an hour long, but there was very little information that was given there.
Right.
You know who won, made the notes, minutes, and how often minutes were done?
A few things here. One of the ways that one of the only ways that we're able to ascertain what actually happened at these board meetings is through the notes of the people who were present, which is one of the things that Your Honor has seen. Holland and Knight lawyers would be the ones that would often devise resolutions and pre-write the resolutions and send them over to KIC. And the board. And so while I can't comment directly to where we can find information about the substance of what happened, they weren't recorded, there wasn't necessarily a transcript of these board meetings. The most we have are the email scheduling the board meetings, the notes and handwritings and scribble that came out of them, and the eventual resolution that we assume crystallized the conversations during the board meeting.
Thank you.
Of course.
Let's take a 10-minute break. Okay. We'll come back at 2:15.
separating at the time that we lose confidence. We maintain our redundancy.
We are back on record.
All right, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I rushed you, sorry.
No, we had a little AV issue, so we set up a projector, but now we're back, I think, on the screen.
All right, do we have everyone we need on both sides there?
Yes, Your Honor. Over here.
Okay.
Will did? Yeah. Mr. Ehrenhaus just stepped out.
Okay.
He took advantage of the AV.
While we're just waiting for him, Your Honor, Friday, the 1 o'clock hearing, is that
We'll do Zoom.
Zoom, okay.
We'll do Zoom, yeah.
Okay.
And we're good on Monday. Or, sorry, Friday, 1 o'clock. Okay. All right. Okay.
Change roll. Okay. Maybe we start anyway.
Here we go.
There he is. Okay. May it please the court. Thank you for your patience there. Your Honor, this hour is about a legal gatekeeping decision. As the court knows and has already heard, punitive damages are fundamentally different from compensatory damages. The compensatory damages address harm. The punitive damages address motive and state of mind. And even KIC's acknowledged that Alaska law makes clear that punitive damages are disfavored and exceptional.
All right, got to hand out the binders.
As the court knows in ordering this proceeding, Alaska Statute 09.17.020B permits punitive damages only if KIC proves by clear and convincing evidence, they have to have evidence, that defendant's conduct was either, one, outrageous, including acts done with malice or bad motives, or two, recklessly indifferent to the interests of another person. If KIC cannot clear that high statutory bar, the highest we have in civil practice, we're done here. There's no second phase. We address only the compensatory damages, or the court does. And when the evidence is examined under the correct legal framework, not hindsight, not emotion, no punitive damages are appropriate.
What do you mean, not hindsight?
A lot of the record in this proceeding, which has been a Rule 55 proceeding, not a proceeding with witnesses testifying about the issues that would actually lead to evidence on punitive damages, are looking back. And they're looking back and saying, if this had happened differently, we'd be in this different place. And that's the wrong lens to be viewing this analysis through, because we're looking at state of mind of and the conduct at the time. So it's important that there's actually evidence that Holland and Knight and Mr. Featherly had malice or bad motives at the time to reach the outrageous conduct standard. And that's missing in the record. Or that they acted recklessly indifferent to the interests of another person. That's also missing in the record. But to talk a little bit more about the legal framework and what recklessness and outrage actually mean in Alaska, the Supreme Court has repeatedly emphasized that punitive damages are not presumed, and they're permitted in very limited circumstances. That's the Chismark case that we cite. The burden here, clear and convincing evidence, it is the highest burden in civil law, and it requires proof that something is highly probable. That's the Adkins case that we cite. And critically, punitive damages require more than negligence, more even than gross negligence. That's the Peterson case. For outrageous conduct, the first prong under 09-17-020B, Alaska looks to the intentional infliction of emotional distress standard. Civil Pattern Jury Instruction 3.16, which is at tab 41 of your binder and is now up on the screen, defines extreme and outrageous conduct as conduct that goes beyond all possible bounds of decency and would be regarded as atrocious and utterly intolerable in a civilized community. Conduct that is unreasonable, unfair, or even seriously wrong doesn't qualify for punitive damages, Your Honor. Nothing in the evidence in the record, even taken at its worst, describes conduct that would cause an average Alaskan to react in immediate outrage at the time it occurred. I talk about reckless indifference. For recklessness, Alaska follows the restatement second of torts, section 500, which is Hayes v. Xerox Corp. and Chismar. Recklessness is not inadvertence, it's not incompetence, it's not a lack of skill, and it's not a failure to take precautions. It requires a conscious choice to proceed with knowledge of a substantial and unjustifiable risk, one far greater than ordinary negligence. The analogies the Alaska Supreme Court uses in its cases show really how high this bar is for KIC. First, in State v. Johnson, there's the tent example. Recklessness is like shooting through a tent without knowing whether someone is inside. If you consciously fire a gun into an enclosed space where serious harm is highly probable, that is reckless indifference. Advising a distressed client about a risky business strategy while warning of litigation risk, that isn't in the Curtis notes of the board meetings, is nothing like firing blindly into a tent. Could we put up HGATE 110, which is tab 19 in the binder? These are the notes that to which I just referred, Your Honor, discussing Solston XP's potential reactions to the strict foreclosure, asking the question, is there another way to handle Marsh Creek problems? Solston might express anger, might seek an injunction or restraining order to stop. Unlikely a court would approve of an order unwinding. Still better than the status quo and letting Marsh Creek wither and die due to Solston XP's failure to perform ICOBAY and provide bonding, et cetera.
What's the H and K number on this one?
This is H and K 110 on the second page.
Second page.
Yeah.
And whose note is this?
Sarah Curtis.
Sarah Curtis. Is there a corresponding board meeting minute?
And so the date of this is November 20th, 2017. I'm not sure we have the...
We have it in exhibits.
We'll look for the exhibits. It's not in your binder.
Okay.
Search for the exhibit number for you, Your Honor. We'll come back to that.
I talked about the tent example, Your Honor. The Supreme Court also has a lion example. Context and purpose matter. Shooting at a person is reckless. Shooting at a charging lion to save someone, even if it ends up missing and hitting the person, may not be reckless because the social utility in trying to save the individual from the charging lion. That's the Alaska Supreme Court trying to come up with an analogy for punitive damages in the Neitzel v. State case. Here, Your Honor, Walter Featherly was trying, even if unsuccessfully, to save a collapsing enterprise, preserve jobs, and avoid bankruptcy. Those efforts have social utility, even if the strategy was not successful or even later was deemed wrong. Court also has talked about, or the restatement, actually, that the court looks to, also uses a traffic sign example to contrast recklessness with negligence. Recklessness is intentionally running a stop sign when cars are visibly speeding towards you. Negligence is failing to see the sign because your attention was diverted. KIC's case at most alleges bad judgment. It's not intentionally driving into oncoming traffic. So taken together, Alaska law requires conduct that is highly probable to cause serious harm, is known to be so by the defendant at the time, and consciously chosen anyway. And that standard is not met here. And, Your Honor, my colleagues have handed me a cite to Holland and Knight, Exhibit 108, as the corresponding board minute, board meeting minutes, to go with the Sarah Curtis notes that we just discussed. They just simply indicate this, that Sarah and Walter were there, and there aren't other notes on there on the Mr. Gottstein has put it up on the screen for us. All right, I think board minutes do not always reflect the full scope
of
discussion.
How long of a meeting it was, Fitzgerald?
No.
Usually they say it when it started and when it adjourned, but...
Began at 1:34, but no end.
It's still going on, Your Honor. That's the way it feels.
Yeah.
And, Your Honor, I want to go back. I'm going to keep beating this dead horse about the pleadings. The complaint allegations matter here, and the First Amendment complaint does not plead sufficient punitive conduct. And that's the first and cleanest stopping point for the court to resolve whether the claims are eligible for punitive damage. The complaint alleges malpractice, negligence, breach of fiduciary duty. It does not plead facts that establish malice, outrageousness, or reckless indifference by clear and convincing evidence. In fact, as we heard today and saw in the briefing, KIC's punitive damages argument does not rely on the complaint at all. Its trial brief doesn't even cite to the complaint when arguing for punitive damages. But the best paragraphs for KIC in their complaint are paragraphs 80 to 82, which is tab 1 in your binder. Mr. Gottstein's got them up on the screen, and they're dispositively insufficient. Holland and Knight and Featherly intentionally or negligently deceived KIC. They're pleading intentionally or negligent in each of these paragraphs. We know negligence cannot support punitive damages as a matter of law, and the pleading itself never commits anything to the required mental state to establish punitive damages. It's a throwaway word in the complaint. As one of our experts explains, Jeff Feldman, which is at tab 3, paragraphs 28 through 31 of his affidavit, even if all of the allegations in the complaint are deemed admitted, they do not cross over the punitive threshold based on his experience practicing in Alaska for generations now. And, Your Honor, this is different than the Haynes v. Comfort Keepers case, where the complaint itself alleged explicit criminal conduct, stealing jewelry, stealing medication, administering discontinued drugs. So if the court cabins its inquiry to the complaint, as it should, punitive damages end here. But if the court does go further, it should consider Mr. Featherly's motive and state of mind. So I'd like to talk a little bit about Mr. Featherly, because I'm frankly astounded by the way he's been characterized in these proceedings. And, Your Honor, Mr. Featherly would like to be here this week. His wife has stage 4 cancer and is in late stages, and he's providing 24/7 care to her. So he's unable to be here. Your Honor, punitive damages turn on motive and state of mind. So it's important to pause briefly on who Walter is, what he was trying to do, not to excuse mistakes, but to assess whether his conduct was malicious, outrageous, or reckless. I want to first talk about his relationship to Alaska Native communities. He's not.
Is this coming from an affidavit?
It's from his affidavit, Your Honor. He did not come to KIC as an outsider looking for a fee. He spent more than 4 decades practicing in Alaska. He grew up in a rural village, the son of public school teachers. After graduating from Harvard Law School, he returned to Alaska and has been committed to supporting Alaskan Native communities. Indeed, he built a career advising Alaska Native corporations on governance, federal contracting, joint ventures, and the 8A program, precisely the issues KIC faced. And he still does so as the general counsel of Calista, the regional corporation for the YK Delta region, which includes the communities in which he lived as a boy. That background matters because punitive damages are not imposed in a vacuum. They ask whether the defendant acted with bad motive or indifference to the client's interests. There's no evidence, none, that Featherly harbored animus towards KIC. viewed it as an easy target, or was indifferent to the consequences for a Native community. Even if Mr. Lampe's affidavit, or even Mr. Lampe's affidavit confirms the degree of trust that existed at the outset of that relationship, at tab 6, we can put up pages 10 and 11 of Mr. Lampe's affidavit, paragraphs 30 and 33. Mr. Lampe says, KIC's board members are not professional directors. We receive little, if any, direct benefit from our service. We're community members elected by our friends and neighbors who trust us to protect the corporation and look out for shareholders in the community. We value that trust deeply. It drives our commitment to KIC. That trust in the community was damaged because we, in turn, placed the trust in defendants who violated the trust with the advice they gave us by taking advantage of us. Go to paragraph 33. Mr. Lampe says, before these events, KIC and its board were confident, relying on professionals and attorneys to guide us through complex business and legal matters. We hired H&K and Mr. Featherly because they were supposed to be the experts, and we trusted them completely. They reassured us constantly that everything would be fine. They had our best interests at heart. As we've come to learn, they lied to us, he says. They knew or disregarded clear indicators that the strategies we're pursuing would not work. They did not disclose that these strategies contained significant risk. Right? Now let's compare that to his deposition testimony as the 30B6 witness binding his testimony for KIC. That's at tab 32 of your binder, Your Honor. 102. He's talking here. We'll start at the top. There's so beyond the board meetings, KIC. Matthew Rexford was talking with the management of Marsh Creek, correct? I believe both him and Walter were talking with the manager. And I don't think there was a lot of times where Matthew didn't speak with management without Walter present. Do you know that? Not for sure, but there's a lot of things that Matthew did, most likely with Walter. He trusted Walter. They had this relationship of trust. Page 132, please. And line 25, going over to 133.
Sorry, what was that again?
132, line 25. There you go. And here again, he testifies that, I believe we trusted the people that enacted the plan of management along with our counsel, Walter Featherly, and his team. Management, they were now executives in charge of each of these companies, right? Yes. And then on to 161, 19, and 20. Can you go up a little bit, Sam? Thanks. Okay. It could have decided a different way. We're talking about the decisions. It could have been decided a different way if it thought that was better, but it didn't, correct? And he says, because of the advice of counsel, we trusted our counsel, right? There was a relationship of trust that existed between KIC and Mr. Featherly. It's a relationship that Mr. Featherly earned, and it's a level of trust that he earned because of his dedication and his commitment to the client that went far back much further than his time at Holland & Knight, to his time at Patton Boggs and beforehand. This was a long-standing relationship of trust and confidence between Walter Featherly and KIC, in which he was looking out for the interests of the members of this community. And the story that you've heard has really been a gross misrepresentation of what occurred with respect to Solston. The history with Solston is a story of Solston exerting pressure to try and take the assets of Marsh Creek. Solston taking away the line of credit at a critical time and support for the line of credit at a critical time while demanding exorbitant prices to allow KIC to buy them out. At risk is the ability to re-qualify for 8A by taking advantage of the assets or using them and putting them to good purpose, spinning them off into other subsidiaries. Let's take a look at tab 12, H&K 40. Pull it up so he can see the author or the. These are from Duane Dudley to Jesse Moorbacher, his notes on withdrawal discussions, November 25th, 2015.
What is withdrawal?
The possibility of pulling out of Marsh Creek. Right. And then if we can walk through this carefully, he's looking at, he's getting advice that says don't do it, right? The value would be received from the sale of hard assets. Going concern of the environmental group will be lost, too much uncertainty. I think we should prepare to buy assets out of a dissolution forced by the withdrawal. Then sell to a native corporation. It's risky, but it will force their hand. We need to prep First National Bank for a purchase, discuss with Jellione. He believes he can arrange for a short-term loan. If we can have millions ready for purchase, that would possibly thwart their plan. Right? We would need to have a discussion in concept with someone to buy the interest from us after we acquire it.
And this is an internal discussion at Solston?
Yeah. And just this is one to keep on going down, sale of Marsh Creek assets to a KSC sub. All right. Turner believes they'll be able to pull that off. Operating agreement won't stop them from being able to sell Marsh Creek's assets to a KSC sub. I agree, operating agreement sells, they can't sell their interest, doesn't say they can't sell assets of Marsh Creek's. It's a legal matter to be researched here, right? Look at whether there's a fiduciary duty or not. If the environmental group's the one being considered for sale, does it constitute all or substantially all of the company due to its contribution to profit? If so, on both, we could litigate to stop. We should litigate to stop unless we're sure KIC has an obligation to have Marsh Creek entertain a higher bid for whatever it is KIC is planning on buying, right?
And what do you want me to see in this?
I'd like you to read a lot of this document, Your Honor, because what we're seeing here, and keep on going down here, Sam.
Next page,
No, a little bit further down on those bullets. If we can't stop immediately with an injunction, we should encourage First National Bank of Alaska and AIDEA to declare Marsh Creek in breach of loan agreements. It would at least slow down progress to some degree. If we can't stop the sale, the proceeds will go to Marsh Creek, and we still may not benefit by them. KIC can block any distribution of the proceeds, claiming Marsh Creek needs all funds for future operations. At that point, we're back to withdrawal, but in 6 months, Marsh Creek management can easily lose millions without the strength of the environmental division to support the rest of the company. And then they walk through a potential fiduciary duty claim, and they talk about valuation. This was Solston is doing exactly what they're accusing KIC of wrongfully doing. That is figuring out a way to take the assets or block KIC from doing so. Can we look at
Turner is a lawyer,
Your Honor. let's take a look also at tab 33.
Yes. So the questions that actually come to mind, it seems like internal discussions and what are the boundaries and parameters of what we can do and can't do seems different than taking actions that might be disregarding the advice of a lawyer to, hey, if we do this, we might be eating a lawsuit.
Well,
it seems like that's a different stage, right?
Yeah.
Let's say if this email identified, there's a couple actions we could take. We're probably going to buy some litigation out of it, and then you go forward anyways. It seems like that's different than just considering what are our options.
The Sarah Curtis notes, in which Holland and Knight, Walter Featherly said disclose to the KIC board risks of litigation, and ultimately the KIC board decides on the course of action, is the same vein.
Yeah.
I think we're seeing.
Yeah, I guess that would have to match up with the series of actions that KIC has undertaken.
Well, and we also know that Solston did, in fact, pull its support for the line of credit, which created a liquidity problem for Marsh Creek. Mm-hmm. I mean, what you're seeing here is hardball business tactics by two parties, right? And one of them, Solston, a very sophisticated party, is trying to use its financial leverage to acquire the assets. KIC, protected by Walter Featherly and Holland and Knight, is trying to find a path for KIC to get through that.
Right.
An ability.
But in doing so, you still have to be careful that you yourself don't, in trying to reach a goal, don't violate responsibilities that you also have. So I see there's a dynamic there, right?
There is, Your Honor.
So I see the interest that you're talking about, but there's also a way that you proceed. You don't, someone you cut off in traffic, someone trying to get your spot in front of you in traffic, that doesn't mean you ram them off the road, because if you do that, then you're going to probably cause some damage and eat a lawsuit, and you get the point.
I do, but that's
what happened. I'm trying to see how far this goes is basically what I'm
saying. Yeah, but that's not what happened, right?
Yeah.
He didn't run anybody off the road. He advised a client that was in a perilous situation dealing with a minority owner who was jumping into the operations in a way that they were not authorized under the governing agreements, that Marsh Creek management was uncomfortable with, that KIC leadership was uncomfortable with. They were losing money. Solston was cutting off their ability to get capital and funds. They couldn't make payroll. Walter gave them an alternative, and he told them it's a risky alternative. And that's documented in the notes to the board meeting.
Which alternative was risky?
All of the alternatives were risky at that point, but the strict foreclosure strategy. There's risk. There's risk of litigation. And that's reflected in those notes.
That's the Curtis email?
It's the Curtis handwritten notes of a board meeting,
okay.
Right? And, Your Honor, I do not profess to be an expert in Alaska Native villages, and I know you've spent considerable time in villages, but my understanding is that the way the Alaska Native communities work together and communicate is by oral communications and gathering and building consensus. It's not the big city lawyer thing of sending the CYA emails and letters all the time. And that it's not surprising, and as Mr. Featherly testified in his affidavit, it's not surprising that the communications he has with these people who he's trusted and who have trusted him and with whom he's worked for a generation want to hear from him orally, want to hear his views, and want to talk to him and ask questions and get answers. And they have the burden here to show by clear and convincing evidence that didn't happen. We just showed you a document that says it did happen. And it happened in a way that's consistent.
That what happened?
That Mr. Featherly said, here's the strict foreclosure strategy, and there are risks associated with it. It's really the opposite of acting reckless or outrageously that we see in the record, notwithstanding the characterizations, what the actual evidence and the facts show. There's just no evidence at all that Mr. Featherly had animus towards KIC. Quite the opposite. It was a relationship of trust. They had been a good client for a long time. He had helped them for a long time, and it had led to a great deal of success for this community. His objective was preservation, not exploitation. He was trying to preserve a Native-owned entity in a crisis situation. Again, by 2017, Marsh Creek had lost its 8A eligibility, had acute liquidity problems, couldn't fund its own payroll. And in fact, Sam, if you put up tab 33B, page 202, Mr. McKay from Marsh Creek testified that the loans were necessary for Marsh Creek to make payroll. KIC had to make these loans. Solston, the minority owner, refuses to put money into the company to cover payroll. KIC, the majority owner, steps up and does it to keep the company afloat. This is hardball by Solston to not put money in and run the risk of a bankruptcy through which it could try and acquire some of the assets. And these are the kinds of things, if we had witnesses and a full-blown trial, Your Honor, it would take a long time to sort out, but it would be sorted out in a way where you could assess credibility and you could hear both sides of the story. In this context, whether the court concludes that Mr. Federley's advice was right or wrong, it was aimed at avoiding bankruptcy, preserving jobs, maintaining contracts, and keeping the value of Marsh Creek from collapsing to benefit KIC. That's just not the mindset of someone acting recklessly indifferent to his client. It's the mindset of a lawyer trying to keep a business alive. Recklessness under Alaska law requires a conscious choice to proceed while knowing that serious harm is highly probable. Come back to those examples from the Supreme Court, shooting blindly into a tent, driving through a stop sign, the lion example. This kind of conduct reflects indifference to consequences. The record here shows the opposite. Federley stayed involved. He attended meetings. He discussed risks. He adjusted strategy after warnings. He didn't walk away at the first sign of trouble. A lawyer who is recklessly indifferent does not spend years trying to salvage a client's enterprise. Cassie argues that because Mr. Federley held himself out as experienced, his failure must be punished, but that's not the way Alaska law works. Expertise raises the standard care for malpractice. It doesn't transform bad outcomes in a case into punitive conduct. If you look at the Alyeska Pipeline Services case versus O'Kelly, the court said, quote, by their very nature, such damages turn on the wrongdoer's motive, state of mind, and degree of culpability rather than the particular tort committed. Even as KIC's experts try and frame the criticisms in terms of poor judgment, or I should say, Your Honor, KIC's experts actually frame the criticisms in terms of poor judgment, inadequate disclosure, the failure to close, and deviations from best practices. That's in the Petuminous affidavit that we heard about this morning and in the Stein affidavits. Those are malpractice concepts, and I'm not sure what's going on with the references to criminal statutes. I mean, I think that's over the top, and today, and at the status conference, I think KIC backed away from that by saying, we're not saying anything criminal happened, but maybe it's criminal-like. It's unclear what they're doing with that kind of allegation, except to try and use explosive words, but they're not providing proof of malice or reckless indifference. They need to show that Mr. Federley knew he was harming his client and proceeded anyway, and there's no such evidence here. I want to tie this back to the statute. When the court asks the statutory question, whether there's clear and convincing evidence that Walter Federley acted with malice, bad motive, or conscious disregard of KIC's destruction, the answer must be no. We understand that based on the striking of the answer, the record supports liability and even negligence, but it does not support outrageous conduct or reckless indifference. He was trying to help his client, Your Honor. Taking the allegations in the complaint as true, he wasn't successful in that goal. And that failure may be compensable with compensatory damages, but it's not punishable with punitive damages. And if the court goes beyond the complaint and looks at the affidavits, Mr. Lampe's affidavit is not sufficient. It's about harm. It's not about Walter Federley or Holland and Knight's mental state. It's about looking in hindsight at what occurred, not looking at what Mr. Federley believed at the time. And Mr. Lampe does not testify that Mr. Federley intended to harm KIC, knew the strategy would devastate KIC, or consciously disregarded KIC's destruction. Nor could he, in good conscience, do so, because it would be false. Wait, Your Honor heard about the Gregoris email. KIC's arguments lean pretty heavily on the Gregoris email, but as an initial matter, a reckless lawyer or one acting with malice doesn't go consult with a colleague to gain the benefit of their view. Consulting with the colleague is the opposite of recklessness. It's showing due care and prudence. And Gregoris did warn that the strategy was, quote, problematic and could result in litigation. That's not a warning of criminality. It's not a warning of inevitable harm. It's not a warning that KIC would be destroyed. Lawyers talk about risk every day. It's what we do. Recognizing risk is not recklessness. And the record shows that Mr. Featherly actually responded to the points that Mr. Gregoris raised. He changed the loan amount. They took on liabilities as well as assets. He warned the board at H&K 110, and Mr. Featherly testifies about that in his deposition at page 46 as well. And he discussed litigation risk in the board meetings, as we showed with the Sarah Curtis.
Is there anything beyond the Sarah Curtis note about describing risk at a board meeting or in an email that he would have sent to Mr. Tickluck or others?
There's not an email.
Does your argument rest on that? That one?
No, Your Honor.
Out of the years that we were talking about representation, is it just that Sarah Curtis note that she writes?
No, Your Honor. First, my argument rests on the fact they haven't proven their case here with clear and convincing evidence. Second,
as far as describing risk, does your argument regarding he told the board about risk rest on anything more than Sarah Curtis' note?
Yeah, what's the tab number on that?
On the tab number. 22.
Tab number 22, Your Honor.
H&K 22.
From our binder, it's Deposition Exhibit B16 is the label on it. It's H&K Exhibit 132.
132, yeah.
At tab 22. It's KIC board meeting agenda from March 5th, 2018, right before the strict foreclosure. So you have a business, a meeting with Mr. Masulich. And we have handwritten notes here. Solson XP, should we purchase 49% of Solson XP before going forth with lawsuit against them? There's a note about the conduct in the meeting, Solston. We talked earlier about management committee meetings and the difficulty KIC had thinking Solston was too aggressive. There's the negligence on the ICO Bay well, right, which is now a problem for Marsh Creek. And eventually proceed to strict foreclosure on Marsh Creek. Don't see the benefit to purchase Solston XP arbitration. Pardon? And there's more on the next page. Okay. Yeah, Mr. Lampe was not at this meeting, Your Honor. You'll see the boxes check who's attended and who was not. And Mr. Lampe's not there.
Right. Whose note is this?
Whose notes are on these pages?
Matthew. I believe there are depositions, but Matthew Rexford is one of them. And I think I hate to guess, maybe Fanny Sokol was the other one.
Okay.
We could find
but these are board minutes.
Yes.
They're notes.
They're notes on the agenda taken during the board meeting.
Which basically became their board minutes. Is that what it was? Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. This is the opposite of conscious disregard. We can talk about the bituminous report since KIC went through it as well. I think their punitive damages case is really based on the bituminous affidavit and the allegations in it. But it doesn't show, by clear and convincing evidence, malice or reckless indifference. He's really offering a malpractice opinion, not one that reflects mens rea. On pages 2 and 3 of his report, it is all a discussion about legal malpractice standards. Pages 7 through 11, it's the rules of professional conduct. Those are all negligence and ethics frameworks, but not the mental state framework required by the statute here for punitive damages. Punitive damages are not awarded because conduct was unethical, incompetent, or even egregiously wrong. They require proof of malice or conscious disregard. Throughout his affidavit and report, he uses highly charged language, scheme, fraud, criminal, theft. He calls it an illegal and actionable scheme and refers to those criminal statutes. There was no criminal charge. There's no prosecution. There's no finding of any criminal intent. And an expert's after-the-fact accusation that conduct could meet a criminal statute is just not clear and convincing evidence that the lawyer acted with malice or reckless indifference at the time. Also, a core flaw in his report is that he repeatedly substitutes should have known for did know. the conduct was obvious or inescapable in hindsight, and that any competent lawyer would have recognized the risk, he says at pages 6 and 7 of his report. Defendants, quote, should have known the consequences, he says at page 9 and 10 of his report. That's not enough. Alaska law requires a conscious choice with knowledge of a substantial and unjustifiable risk, not incompetence, poor judgment, or failure to appreciate the risk. And Mr. Patuganos never testifies that Mr. Featherly recognized that his conduct would likely devastate KIC and that Mr. Featherly proceeded anyway. That evidence doesn't exist because it isn't what happened. Mr. Patuganos also concedes in his report that, quote, this is at page 5, throughout Mr. Featherly's deposition, he continues to show no insight into the problematic conduct. Featherly continues to defend the scheme and sees nothing wrong with it whatsoever, end quote. That statement is actually fatal to their punitive damages claim. A person who does not believe their conduct is wrongful can't simultaneously be found to have acted with malice or conscious disregard of known illegality. Even if he was just wrong, even if he was badly wrong, punitive damages require proof he knew he was doing something wrongful or dangerous and chose to proceed anyway. Patuminus also leans on that Gregoris email. I've already addressed that, so in the interest of time, I'll skip past it. Warning of litigation risk, of course, is not reckless indifference, and his reference to the Gregoris email is not sufficient to establish punitive damages. Standard is met here. Mr. Patuminus is also not the only person testifying about these kinds of issues. His conclusions are directly contradicted by Mr. Feldman, our expert, Jeff Feldman. No malice, no reckless indifference. That's at tab 3 in your binder, paragraphs 18 through 21 of his affidavit and his report, pages 24 through 25. Also by Professor Lee, who teaches corporate law and criminal law. That's right. And he testifies that Mr. Featherly gave lawful, commercially reasonable advice. That's at tab 7, paragraphs 17 through 35. And Mr. Solomon, also a professor of law in transactions. His affidavit's at tab 9, paragraphs 24 through 27, similarly support Mr. Featherly's actions. Experienced professionals disagree about the conduct. Punitive damages can't be awarded in that circumstance because you can't meet the highly probable standard in the statute. At most, Mr. Patuminos' report, even if taken at full value, establishes malpractice and ethical violations, but it does not and cannot establish by clear and convincing evidence that Mr. Featherly or Holland and Knight acted with malice or consciously disregarded a known and unjustifiable risk to KIC. Under the statute and Section B, that means punitive damages are not eligible, and the inquiry ends here. Punitive damages are reserved for the tent shooter, not the lawyer who tried and failed to save a business. They're for the conduct that is utterly intolerable, not conduct that turned out badly. By virtue of the order striking defendant's answer, KIC has proven harm in this case. It has proven malpractice, but it is not proven by clear and convincing evidence outrageous or reckless indifference. As a result, they have not met the standard, and their claims are not eligible for punitive damages, Your Honor.
We'll take just a brief break. And then we'll give each side 20, 30 minutes to, I guess, give me a preview of what you wanted to touch on, Mr. Slarsky.
Well, I wanted to address a couple points from yesterday. And I suppose I can also address a couple of points that that Mr. McGuire just made in his punitives as our rebuttal for that.
I think what I'll do is just limit each side to 30 minutes, and you can cover whatever you'd like to cover over the yesterday and today. Does that seem fair? Yeah. Okay, so we'll come back at 11 after. Okay, please have a seat once more. Let's check our time. It's way up 3:15, so Mr. Slursky, 30 minutes.
Thank you. I'm just going to start with a few words on where we just left off with the punitives, Your Honor. This section of the hearing is A and, is the A and B section, whether there's reckless indifference or outrageous conduct. I'm not going to belabor the point. Your Honor is quite familiar with recklessness from being a trial judge for years. The evidence that we've presented is clear evidence of recklessness. Much of what Mr. McGuire presented to you, I think, goes to the nature of, if punitives are available, how should they be calibrated? But not to the first question, which is, you know, was there reckless indifference to KIC's interests and rights? And ultimately, taking a look at the exhibits that Mr. McGuire pointed to.
If you look at Holland and Knight 110, the notes,
it confirms and corroborates the narrative that we've been telling you, which is that you know, the advice that Holland and Knight gave the KIC board was 80% of the advice. And what they didn't say is that what we're advising you to do is unadvisable. It's not good advice because you will get sued. It's illegal. It's reckless. It's reckless to Marsh Creek. It's reckless to your interests. You know, there's a comment in here in the notes. Still better than status quo and letting MC wither and die due to Solston XP's failure to perform ICO Bay, et cetera, et cetera. Set aside the question about ICO Bay, would KIC have been better off if it had just allowed Marsh Creek to wither and die, or was it better off going into this strict foreclosure, exposing itself to $7 million of liability, the distraction, the destruction of the relationship with Solston? What Holland and Knight didn't do and what defendants didn't do is tell KIC that the strategy could not work because it was unlawful. And that's really sort of the crux of it. I mean, the reckless conduct goes on for years, but this is the culmination of it, which is that this strict foreclosure strategy and the reason why punitive damages are ultimately going to be important to award here, this is not a lawyer giving bad advice. This is a lawyer who has gone so far across the line. And, you know, Your Honor, you're a trial judge. My submission, you asked yesterday, why did this happen? I think that there are personal instincts involved. People get involved. People become invested in what they're doing. And I think Walter Featherly was acting by any means necessary to win against Solston. And he wasn't advising the client on an advisable strategy for preserving its interest in Marsh Creek. I mean, we've seen that over and over again. The 8A strategy, Mr. McGuire this morning told you the 8A strategy could never work, because it's really hard to stand up, you know, most of these companies fail when they come out of 8A, right? It's really hard to stand up new entities. Most of these companies fail, I believe is what he said yesterday, when they graduate from 8A. Well, then why are they advising them into this 8A strategy and trying to seize assets through a fiduciary misconduct strict foreclosure plan and put them into new 8A entities? This kind of legal advice is the kind of legal advice that should be deterred because it's unlawful. That's ultimately what we're dealing with here. Trying to influence business appraisers, trying to get them to lowball the valuation on a company when you're dealing with a fair market value is unlawful. That's not conduct that reasonable lawyers engage in. Taking a business valuation, handing it to a third-party auditor who tells you when they give you materials back, this is educational. These are a bunch of illustrations to help you understand the concepts, okay? And using that and using it today, even today in their timeline, Your Honor, they describe those materials for you as a valuation. It's not a valuation. It was never a valuation. telling the KIC board, hey, here's our M&A guy, and then letting him bill 20 hours over the next 3 years because Walter Featherly's ego got in the way of allowing KIC to have the benefit of a very strong law firm, one of the biggest law firms, strongest law firms in the country, in the world. His ego got in the way. He couldn't let the M&A guy take charge of the mandate, have a reasonable conversation with Solston over the business valuation. How do we structure this? How do we get Alaska Growth Capital in? KIC has limited upfront money. What do we do about that? No, no, no. His solution was cook the books. Okay? This is the kind of conduct we're talking about. I don't take any pleasure from being up here, from coming to Alaska from New York to represent this client. I really don't. So that's what we're talking about with the punitive damages. That's why it's reckless indifference. That's why you should at least consider, you should at least determine that this is the kind of conduct that over a period of years and with catastrophic effects for our client should be deterred. Now, the amount of that is something that will be determined at another day. But whether this pattern of conduct that we've been over for the last several days amounts to a repeated instance of reckless indifference to the rights of others. And it doesn't have to just be KIC. There's this undercurrent here about KIC and Solston. You know, are we really here for Solston's interests? Are we here for KIC's interests? The punitive damages statute is different because you're talking about deterring conduct that impacts third parties, whether it's KIC or Solston. And it is legitimate to ask about how Solston was influenced here. They were a 49% owner of the company, as Your Honor mentioned. They had a substantial stake in this company. They wanted to have a continuing relationship with KIC, which was destroyed. Why was it destroyed? Because they were negotiating with somebody who was acting with fraud. He was putting fraudulent figures in front of them, telling them it's a valuation. It wasn't. That's where this all started. And it continued and compounded over the years because when he couldn't get over with his valuation, he then clamped down. Your Honor asked about the management committee meetings. How could things run better? I want to show you a document from Jesse Moorbacher from Solston when the Ico Bay events came up. It's H&K.
Will I have it up here?
You will.
Okay.
I'm going to show it to you, too. It's H&K. You may not have it there, but I'm going to put it up. H&K 86. This is July 7th, 2017. Okay? Just for context, the letter, the correspondence between Ms. Kale and Mr. Featherly was around May 17, right? So things are heating up between the lawyers. Jesse Moorbacher, who, if you remember, the Gebhardt appraisal says Solston and Jesse have had a long, KIC and Solston have had a long, productive relationship. Jesse Moorbacher reaches out to Matthew Rexford, the president of KIC. Dear Mr. Rexford, we have not had an opportunity to talk since your appointment this year as president of Kaktovik Inupiat Corporation, KIC. Congratulations. Best wishes for many successes. I look forward to working with you. I'm writing to you today to address Walter Featherly's letter to Natalie Kerr. Humbly request your review of the nature, tone, and accuracy of the letter. My hope is that the acrimony and aggression expressed in Mr. Featherly's letter does not faithfully reflect your position or the position of the KIC Board of Directors. I'm hoping further to prompt a meeting between you at your option, our respective attorneys, to seek an alternative to the litigious approach presented by Mr. Featherly. We've been partners for a very long time. We've each received dividends of nearly $11 million. If KIC pursues the approach being undertaken by Holland and Knight, the impacts to each of KIC, Solston, and Marsh Creek may be very grave indeed. Okay, Solston is reaching out with an olive branch to suggest a different path here. What had effectively happened through whatever, I don't know exactly, Your Honor, but effectively, Walter Featherly drove a wedge between KIC and Solston. Walter Featherly, when we say he breached fiduciary duties to KIC and that he inserted himself between KIC and Solson, what we're saying is that effectively Walter Featherly made himself KIC's partner in managing the KIC interest in Marsh Creek. And Walter Featherly took it upon himself to interface with Solston. And for whatever reason, Walter Featherly destroyed that relationship. And you can go through this record up and down, Your Honor, and what you will consistently see, don't be gaslighted, or gaslit, I guess is the proper word. Don't be gaslit. Believe what your eyes see. When you go through the emails, you will see Solston repeatedly engaging, trying to get to a productive outcome. And you will see that they are constantly met by abrasiveness. So, you know, there was another path. There's an arbitration clause in the operating agreement. I'm going to show you that. Let's go through. There are a couple points in the operating agreement I want to show you. That's KIC2. Okay. At 4, there's a books provision, okay? Access to books and records. The members or their authorized representatives at all times shall have access to the books and records. Okay, that would presumably include the appraisal, okay? It's a record of the company at some point. They're obtaining an appraisal to consider a financing. At page 9, there are rights of members. We've talked a lot about the role of minority members. Each of the members, Solston's is a member, shall not be entitled to participate in the day-to-day affairs. Instead, the members shall participate with respect to matters relating to the company, right to vote or otherwise participate with respect to matters relating to the company shall be limited to those matters. Fiduciary duties. Notwithstanding the statute, each member shall have fiduciary duties to the other members, in addition to any fiduciary duties he or she has as a manager. There's a broad fiduciary responsibility adopted in the operating agreement. Meetings of members. Members have the right to call meetings. Okay, I just want to sensitize, Your Honor, to the fact that there are, you know, this is, I showed you the withdrawal and acquisition of interest provision before. There are rules here to govern disputes. You know, another one is there's an arbitration clause, which was ultimately triggered. If Walter Featherly thought that Solston was being so unfair or being so outrageous in how it was handling whatever it was alleged to be doing, he could have started an arbitration at any point.
Can a member unilaterally declare that another member is violating fiduciary duties and to the point that they say, we no longer owe you a fiduciary duty? Or does that need to go to arbitration?
I don't think that a member has the right to unilaterally make that determination.
And where in the operating agreement do you see that?
Well, where do I see that it's not a right?
Yeah, I'm just trying to, if I'm a member, where would I look to where that gets sorted out? Does it have to wait for arbitration to be figured out, or?
I think there are default provisions, you know, under the operating agreement, but ultimately, if there's a disagreement, no one member gets to automatically determine whether there's a dispute. I suppose if one person asserts a default and the other doesn't believe they're in default, they could start an arbitration. There are ways to handle that as well.
That would have to be sorted out through arbitration as well, right? I mean,
sure,
because there's a provision for that.
I mean, it's a broad arbitration clause. I mean, we can go down the road of interpreting arbitration clause, but I believe it's a broad arbitration clause.
I'm just trying to see the basic operation of.
Yeah, in the event of a dispute between the members with respect to any aspect of the company or this agreement.
Right. It's arbitration.
It's arbitration. It all goes to arbitration. You asked yesterday, I'm just trying to respond to a couple points. you know, you asked yesterday, why shut the management committee meetings down? Part of the answer that Mr. Hollander gave you was, well, it allows Mr. Featherly to control the narrative. It allows him to exert control over the board, over the executives of Marsh Creek. It feeds his narrative in trying to achieve what he's trying to achieve. If Solston is participating there, even just as a participant at the meetings, it can ask questions, right? It may not make the decisions, but it can ask a question, and it can say to, you know, the management committee, it can have a direct conversation with, you know, Mr. Rexford or whoever is there, or the officers of Marsh Creek, and make suggestions and say, hey, you know, maybe we need to cut overhead if our revenues are not keeping up with our expenses. You know, maybe we can't be granting bonuses this year. Maybe this is a year where we, you know, pull back on that and reposition and do something else. Solston really is the management partner of this company and has been for years, that has operational and business acumen to bring to the plate. Walter Featherly is a lawyer. Now, some lawyers are entrepreneurs as well, but lawyers do lawyer things typically and are not always the most astute business people. Solston actually has a multifaceted logistics and operating business to help the management get to the right decisions. KIC 115 I showed you yesterday, where in May 2018, Mr. Dudley says, has this always been your goal, to run down Marsh Creek, to take some operating losses? He says, when you told me several years back, maybe we just need some operating losses to run the value down, I thought, you know, I was naive enough to think you wouldn't really do it. Maybe he did, okay? Maybe when Solston wouldn't adhere to the fraudulent valuation-like numbers that Holland and Knight used for the basis of their counteroffer, maybe what Mr. Featherly did, instead of saying, hey, we have a problem here, which is your fair market interest is worth X dollars, okay? KIC can only pay Y dollars. We need to structure a transaction or come up with a different price, right? Instead of dealing with it openly and honestly and meeting your partner where they are, he chose a different path. And that was what Mr. Louis Pierre was saying this morning. Repeatedly, he chooses a different path, and it's a path that is dishonest. It's a path that is egocentric. It is a path that is not taking into concern the impact on KIC or the impact on Solston. That's what's reflected in the evidence. That's what needs to be deterred. That's why we're still here 15 years later fighting. You know, Mr. Lampe talks about in his affidavit that at some point he realized, and KIC, the board, realized that Walter Featherly had turned KIC against Solston, made them believe that Solston was the enemy. Why? Maybe it was because Solston had a fair market value that was real, that they understood. That was the same as the appraiser's value, right? And the way Mr. Featherly knew to try to get that value down wasn't to deal with it openly and honestly and fairly. It was to demonize Solston, to take control of all the information, right, and to run the value of the company down, to try to make the value meet. Now, as late as October 2016, we showed you the memo, the Sarah Curtis memo about the 8A entities that she sent to the KIC board, where she says in October 2016, both parties still want to have a deal done. It's at the bottom of the memo. The top of the memo is all about the 8A process. It's October 20th, 2016, I think. They're still trying to get a deal done. At that point, okay,
look at these notes.
Here we are on the eve of the strict foreclosure. Sarah Curtis's notes say she says that they don't need to buy Solston anymore, that they don't need to buy out Solston anymore. Sorry.
It's a second.
second page.
My point is that until the very end, the idea is always to acquire the 49% interest. Okay, they're telling you yesterday, today, that could never be done. KIC didn't have the money. If that's the case, then what are we doing here? Why is Holland and Knight not just telling the client, hey, guys, you can't do this. We're not going to run fees on you trying to do a deal that you can't afford. That's not reality. The reality is everybody was trying to accomplish this. But in order for it to happen, they had to get to a price. Now, it had to be a price KIC could pay, sure, or a deal that KIC could do, right, because the cash was never going to come from KIC. The cash was going to be financed. But it also had to be a fair market value. It had to be a value that Solston could understand as well. And the problem we had is that Walter Featherly's way of bridging that understanding was not through open, fair negotiation. It was through the conduct that you've seen the last couple days. Yesterday you heard Mr. McGuire say that the best evidence that the appraisal wasn't reliable is that KIC didn't transact. I mean, maybe that's just rhetoric, but if that's the best evidence that the appraisal wasn't reliable, then there's no evidence that the appraisal wasn't reliable. Because whether somebody transacts or not is not material to whether the appraisal is an accurate valuation of a company. The fact is there's no evidence that the Gabehart appraisal was incorrect. That's another thing that was said yesterday. The appraisal was incorrect because of what happened afterwards. It's a nonsensical argument. An appraisal is a snapshot at a point in time. It didn't value Marsh Creek at its peak. That's another thing that was said to you yesterday. The Gabehart appraisal valued Marsh Creek at its peak. Well, in fact, the Scripps appraisal 3 years earlier said Marsh Creek was worth $5 million more. So if anything, the peak came 3 years earlier. An appraisal is a snapshot in time. There's no way to know, or it takes into account the possibility of what could happen in the future or what might not happen in the future, right? You know, that's the nature of a business valuation. It's just an assessment of what that business is worth at that time based on everything. The hard assets, the contracts, the employees, the relationship that has been there for 10 years, 15 years. It's an operating company. Counsel suggested that Gabehart's work was somehow categorically rejected by KIC or Marsh Creek, its operation, its personnel. That is not the case. There's no evidence of that, contemporaneous evidence of that. They went back to Gabehart 2 years later for an update, and going into that meeting, KIC 32 is a November 2015 email from Sarah Curtis to Doug Kaprowski of Marsh Creek, Mick McKay, John Ely of Marsh Creek, talking about the update Marsh Creek appraisal. She asks them for new information, right? She's looking for an update because she's sending it to him. These are interspersed. And Kaprowski says, good morning, Sarah. We'd be glad to have a conference call with Scott, but it will have to wait until either next Monday or next Tuesday with Mick. You don't see emails in this record with people saying, why are we going back to Gabehart? That guy's a bum. You know, that guy overinflated the appraisal. You know, we've known for the last 2 years that what he did was garbage. You know, it's garbage in, garbage out. We can't go back to him. Let's go get, you know, tell him to go get a new appraiser. You don't see that in this record. You see, oh, yeah, we'll be happy to meet with Scott. Give us a day or two so Mick can be here, too, because Mick wants to meet with him also, presumably. I mean, you know, this is what you're seeing in this record. The last thing I want to do, Your Honor, is I want to make some comments on the timeline. You know, you gave me a little bit of a hard time. I have a jury mindset as well, Your Honor, and I get concerned when people put together demonstratives. I just want to look at them in advance before they're shown because things tend to have an impression on people and you want them to be accurate. So I took a look at the timeline. I asked Mr. McGuire to send me an electronic copy last night, which he was courteous to do. And a couple of these points are, you know, more significant than others, I'll acknowledge. The first one is that you know, here's September 30th, 2014, Holland and Knight says, KIC proposes an alternative valuation of Solston's share. Your Honor, that's not true. I would object to that, because the evidence that we've looked at is that the personnel who prepared that array of numbers specifically said this is not a valuation, can't be relied on as a valuation. It's an educational illustration of how net present value calculations work, so that you can work, you know, you can talk about this with your clients, and so that you'll understand it. I would object to that, Your Honor. I would say we can't put in front of a jury the notion that this is a valuation. There's no evidence to support that. Page 5, I saw as I was going through this, Solston sets up a plan to force dissolution. Okay, November 2015. And I thought, that's interesting. I don't recall seeing that evidence. So I went and I looked at the exhibit, which we looked at today in the punitive damages proceeding. This is H&K 40. That's cited there. This is the email that was excerpted in front of you about the notes on the withdrawal discussion with Turner. First of all, it's not Solston planning to force Marsh Creek into dissolution. It's Solston in November 2015, a year after those fraudulent valuation materials were supplied to them, and they've been trying to get information to understand why this is the negotiating position that Featherly is advancing, right? A year later, a year after they've been told that they can't get information, they're starting to talk about triggering withdrawal under the operating agreement. That's what this email shows. Okay, Turner is their lawyer. Turner advises against withdrawal. Okay, I told you, Your Honor, that there was no triggering of withdrawal in this action. Candidly, I wasn't aware of this email. Okay, I would have brought it to your attention earlier. This is our email, not their email. Okay. Because what this shows is withdrawal is complex under the operating agreement. You have to give 6 months' notice. It triggers certain procedures. They didn't want to formally withdraw. They wanted to do a friendly deal with KIC to support KIC. But now, a year after they've been shut down and presented with garbage information, right, they're starting to think about their other options, and they talk about withdrawal. Turner advises against value received will be from sale, you know, too much uncertainty. This bullet point, the sale of MC assets to KIC sub, reflects that Walter Featherly had threatened Solston, well, we'll just sell all the assets at a fire sale price to our subsidiary. We can do that. We control the company. Okay, that's what's going on here. Turner says, well, I don't think they can pull that off. The operating agreement won't stop them. Dwayne says, operating agreement says they can't sell their interest. It doesn't say they can't sell the assets. They actually thought at the time maybe they could sell everything. I mean, you can't do that as a fiduciary, but they're talking about it, okay? The only mention of dissolution in here.
Couple more minutes.
The only mention of dissolution in here is that a dissolution might result from Solston withdrawing its support from Marsh Creek, which they didn't want to do. Would they have been able to find some other business relationship? Sure, they're well invested in this entity, right? They have a business to run as well. They're entitled to 49% of the value. So would they act reasonably as business people? Sure. The point of this email, Your Honor, is that it's presented to you, okay, as if this is some nefarious plot by Solston to force a dissolution. That's what's in their timeline. That's what we were looking at, right? Solston's plotting the dissolution. I'd object to that. The evidence doesn't show that they were setting up a plan to force a dissolution of Marsh Creek, but that's the demonstrative they want you to look at. The other thing they cited here is the Dudley deposition, 146 to 149. I pulled that up, too. This was crazy. Okay? Where's the Dudley transcript here? Look at what he says when he discussed this in his deposition. Question: so you're writing a plan to thwart a plan they may have to dissolve the company, that they may have to dissolve the company. Is that right? That's what's written there. Yes. It's exactly the opposite of what's on the timeline they presented to you, Your Honor.
What is this one? Dudley Depo. What's the site?
This is 148, lines 16 to 18.
I'm sorry, is this H&K or KIC?
This is the B, it's B05, B-05. It's attached to the Gilmore affidavit. But it's exactly the opposite.
Right, but if I wanted to look at it, is it an H&K affidavit?
It was submitted by H&K as a deposition transcript. I think it's entitled B05.
Okay.
And my point is it's exactly the opposite.
About 30 seconds.
I've got only 30 seconds left, Your Honor, because what I want to emphasize for Your Honor is you've heard a lot of words over the last couple of days. Mr. McGuire, as he pointed out to you, is recent to the case over the last couple of months. I give him the benefit of the doubt. But we ask the court to dig behind the words that are presented. I don't need to remind this court that the words of lawyers are not evidence. The evidence is in front of this court, and the evidence is in front of this court as a consequence of the same conduct in this litigation that went on for 10 years prior between KIC and Holland and Knight. Just denial. Denial of the misconduct, denial of discovery obligations, denial of their representations to the court. I guess that, you know, we all know that they're setting this up for appeal. They've said it as much. I guess they're hoping that the appellate court will bail out their denials, but it's the same thing. They're doing it here in the timeline that they presented to you. This court made very strong findings. I'm sure I'm done with my 30 seconds. Thank you, Your Honor.
Like I said, I appreciate it. Like I said, many words could be spoken. All right, Mr. McGuire.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You'll get the full 30 if you'd like.
I appreciate that. Your Honor, I want to just start actually with addressing the allegations concerning Mr. Von Bergen, who's the M&A lawyer at Holland & Knight. Because KIC has painted this involvement. Oh, sorry, it's a binder. Not sure if we're using this binder.
These have been helpful, just so you know.
Oh, good. I think you're getting the same documents like 8 times, however, in these binders.
Well, I mean, if you saw the binders at my house.
They usually come down to 20 documents anyway, right?
Yeah, they do. And I'll say, Mr. Slarsky, I do agree on one thing. Look at the evidence. Yeah. Look at the evidence. But we read it very, very differently, Your Honor.
Excellent.
And with respect to the Van Bergen, or Von Bergen, I keep calling him Van Bergen, it's Von Bergen, Your Honor. KSC's painted the involvement of Mr. Von Bergen as a, quote, bait and switch, right? Kind of thing you'd hear going to the jury. Nothing could be further from the truth here. It's a pretty transparent attempt to try and transform a standard legal malpractice allegation into the UTPA world of events and to the punitive damage arguments, but it's wrong for 3 reasons. First, it misrepresents the role he played in the representation. It overlooks Mr. Featherly's experience and expertise, and it misconstrues the standard of care as defined by the rules of professional responsibility. They told a story yesterday about his involvement that just doesn't fit the facts in the record. In your response to Your Honor's questioning, KIC argued that the time for an M&A specialist to get involved in these negotiations was when a term sheet was received. Now, defendants don't think that's right. I don't think that's right. That's not an accurate description of what the law requires. And having worked with my business colleagues who are M&A lawyers, that's not what happens. Price negotiation is not an intricate, specialized field. It's a common part of every lawyer's practice, or many lawyers' practices, especially in a jurisdiction like Alaska, where there are a lot of jacks of all trades, lots of generalists who work across many areas of law, but perfectly capable of trying to negotiate to a price before involving the specialists who have to paper the deal very carefully. Nonetheless, Mr. Featherly involved Mr. Von Bergen early, right when KIC says they should have, immediately after an offer, a term sheet was received. In our UTPA binder, we had a tab. It's also in this binder, which I don't think you gave me a binder. Okay, we do. Okay, so in the binder that was just given to you, I don't think it's in this binder. No, it's not. It's in the UTPA binder from earlier.
What's the exhibit?
H and K 211.
The billing records.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It is in fact in the new binder. I was wrong. H and K 211. It's at tab 4. These are billing records, Your Honor. It's a log of the billing records and the time entries for the KIC Solston matter. KIC gave you a new exhibit today that had a purported to be a summary of the billing records as well. If you take a look, Your Honor, at page 1 of that document, you'll see that on June 25, 2014, Sarah Curtis and Walter Featherly met with Dwayne Dudley to discuss KIC's potential acquisition of Solston's share in Marsh Creek. That's the meeting where Solston presented the $12.5 million offer. 2 days later, June 27th, Walter and Sarah Curtis conferred with Mr. Von Bergen about the transaction. Shortly thereafter, on July 1st, Mr. Von Bergen joined the KIC board meeting by phone. On July 28th, less than a month later, Mr. Von Bergen joined a call with BDO. This is that $5 million, whatever you want to call it, to analyze Solston's offer.
What are you calling the whatever you want to call it?
Mr. Slarsky took umbrage with our timeline, referring to it as a $5 million. Remember the valuation. Discussions with BDO, the valuation, or is it not a valuation? What is it? It's for discussion purposes only. That's what it was. Yeah. And on July 28th.
I mean, it is an important distinction, right? I mean, they weren't hired to be evaluate or to provide a valuation. It's the auditors, and so you're really using them on the QT to do something that they don't normally do.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
It's not a.
But it's data about. That helps inform somebody's opinion about what the company could be worth. It's not a formal valuation.
As long as it's used in that way, sure.
Yeah. I mean, I think we all know you can hire 5 different valuation experts, and they could be off by 100% from one another. So there are lots of different ways that you can gather information to try and assess how much a company is worth. Going to the auditor and getting that information from BDO is just one of them, and it's information to help analyze Solston's $12.5 million offer. But the point is here, July 28th, you've got Mr. Von Bergen there again. He joined a call with BDO to walk through these issues. And Your Honor should not put much stock in KIC's characterizations of the amount of time Mr. Von Bergen recorded. Ms. Curtis notes communications with Mr. Von Bergen in her time records that he doesn't actually record. Like, he didn't write down all his time to charge this client. He had a long-standing relationship with Mr. Featherly. They worked together on a lot of deals. He understood not to run the meter on a small Alaska Native corporation.
And is that in a depot somewhere?
No, I can have Mr. Featherly come testify when he's available to do so as an offer
just
of proof.
Trying to keep.
And Mr. Von Bergen would do the same. We
I'm
talked
to
him
to
this morning.
I'm trying to keep things to the record. That's all I'm trying to do.
I think that, fair enough, Your Honor. On August 29th, the time records show Mr. Von Bergen, again, reviewed valuation materials. And, Your Honor, the records do show Sarah Curtis communicating with Mr. Von Bergen where she records time and he doesn't. That is in the record, and it's in here, for example, on August 18, 2014. On August 29th, Mr. Von Bergen reviewed valuation materials, joined another call with BDO. On September 9th, he attended another KIC board meeting to discuss the Solston proposal. On September 29th, his time entry says, reviewed draft of correspondence to Solston regarding the offer. On September 30, Von Bergen reviewed and revised correspondence to Mr. Dudley regarding valuation issues. He continued engaging with Holland and Knight and helping them formulate a counteroffer for KIC throughout the spring of 2015. When he reviewed models for the acquisition and attended teleconferences with Mr. Tiklick and Fannie Soplum. on July 17, 2015, when the next round of negotiations kicked off with KIC's counteroffer to Solston, Von Bergen got involved again, participating in a conference call with Walter Featherly and Dwayne Dudley regarding KIC's proposal. Then in January 2016, Von Bergen helped review the 2015 Gay Park valuation, participating in three conference calls between January 12th and February 4th, 2016. He continued to engage on issues related to valuation, attending another call with BDO on February 19th and another KIC board meeting on March 17th. On March 21, Von Bergen again reviewed and revised spreadsheets regarding the acquisition of Marsh Creek. The next day, March 22, he conferred with Walter Featherly about strategy for going forward with a buyout. While H&K attorneys, Holland & Knight attorneys, continued to talk with Solston and communicate with him and explore options for buying out Solston's shares, no serious M&A discussions went forward after this time. No additional term sheets were exchanged. There was no need for an M&A specialist thereafter, under even KIC's view of when one should be engaged. But finally, he was involved in reviewing the secured loans KIC made to Marsh Creek in late 2017. It's not only the time entries that show that he was involved, he was also copied on a number of the key emails in the record as exhibits. KIC argued yesterday that one example of Holland & Knight misconduct was an email where Sarah Curtis forwarded the BDO analysis to Dwayne Dudley for discussion. That's KIC 12. But Mr. Von Bergen, who KIC claims was critical, was copied on that very email. He's part of the discussion. He was also included on emails circulating and discussing the 2015 Gay Park valuation. Those are KIC 33 and KIC 34. And an early 2026 email chain in which Holland & Knight's conferred with BDO and Marsh Creek executives concerning potential offers also includes him. That's KIC 35. So while Mr. Von Bergen, who is a senior partner now retired, with whom we communicated this morning to make sure that if the court was interested in an offer of proof, we could provide him, and he was willing. As a senior partner with a high billing rate, he wasn't involved in the day-to-day running of the matter, but he was involved in the key junctures. In his deposition, Mr. Featherly testified that the reason Mr. Von Bergen limited his billing on the matter was because the parties were, quote, miles apart, and that Mr. Featherly was, quote, cognizant of KIC's financial situation, and that it was necessary to keep bills reasonable. That's in Mr. Featherly's deposition, which in our filings was Appendix B9. Pages 262 through 63. Your Honor, the Von Bergen story, again, shows the opposite of a law firm failing its client or Mr. Featherly failing his client. It shows, in fact, his expertise was brought to the table. He was involved in the communications, even early. He was aware of the term sheets. He participated or attended KIC board meetings. This is diligence. It's not malpractice. It's not a UTPA violation, and it's certainly not punitive, worthy of punitive damages. Your Honor knows, and we all know, this is a Rule 55 damages-only proceeding. Liability may be deemed admitted here, but damages are not. The court's remaining task here is quite narrow. It's to award only those damages that were pleaded, proven, and actually caused, not to rewrite history or issue a windfall. 3 points end this case. First, the ceiling. The only damages ever quantified in the complaint are tied to that arbitration. That arbitration already decided the value question at the only relevant time, 2018, when the strict foreclosure happened. And the arbitrator found that Marsh Creek had no going concern value and that KIC received $8 million in assets through the foreclosure. Any arbitration-related damages must be offset by the value received and capped at amounts actually paid. On this record, there's no net loss to compensate. Second, the enterprise value claim as a loss of equity value fails as a matter of law. They asked for tens of millions of dollars on this new unpled equity loss theory that years earlier it would have bought Solston out, would have obtained financing, would have reinstated 8A status, would have avoided ICO Bay somehow, and would have preserved the high value of Marsh Creek. But Rule 55 doesn't allow damages based on a counterfactual and speculative hypothetical history. Alaska law requires reasonable, non-speculative basis tied to pleaded conduct. There isn't the connection here. And awarding equity loss on top of arbitration damages would be double recovery, especially given the assets KIC retained and monetized. The third point to end this case, enhancements are unavailable here. The UTPA trebling fails because the damages are not traceable back to the UTPA actionable pled conduct in the complaint. The claims here are malpractice claims. Punitive damages fail because the evidence, far from clear and convincing, that they have to prove shows crisis management. That's what was happening. Not malicious or reckless indifference. This was a last resort strategy in a collapsing business. It was not outrageous conduct. The court should not be writing blank checks, shouldn't be entertaining new theories, shouldn't be engaged in speculation. The law permits at most an offset capped arbitration related amount of actually paid damages to compensate KIC for what it actually lost. Even that's doubtful given the value KIC received. Everything else must be denied. And even in the rebuttal, Mr. Solarski had a lot to say about Solston and put up a letter from Solston. It's not at all surprising that Solston did not like Mr. Featherly. It's not surprising that they send letters complaining about him. Mr. Featherly didn't represent Solston. He didn't have a duty to them as KIC's lawyer. His duty was to KIC, and he performed that duty to the point where he annoyed Solston for sure, and Solston was concerned as to where things were going with Marsh Creek because Mr. Featherly was advocating for a result to benefit his client, KIC. That's what the record shows. It shows Mr. Featherly doing everything he could to help them. Your Honor asked Mr. Solarski about the ability to declare a member in default. Well, the operating agreement at HK1, page 13, Article 10, has a section on default, and Section 2 is on remedy under Article 10. The court can look there. Yes, there are certain acts that lead to a default. And yes, you can end up in arbitration, but as a practical matter, what happens out there is somebody says, one of the members says, you're in default, I'm going to treat you like you're in default. And then a dispute happens, and somebody says, you either had the right to do that or you didn't. Your Honor, the story here is of a lawyer, Walter Featherly, who had earned the trust of his client with years of dedicated service, who stuck with the client in perilous times, with a business failing, and Solston doing everything it could to interfere in management operations and undercut any prospect for success. And Mr. Featherly gave them an option Mr. Lampe acknowledged in his deposition testimony was a Hail Mary. Nobody else had a solution here for KIC. Indeed, nothing in KIC's voluminous filings offers an alternative solution to what could have worked to help KIC. The record shows, and I just showed them to you in the punitive damages section, that the strict foreclosure strategy was disclosed to the KIC board along with the risks. And KIC took the risk. But it's now trying to blame its lawyer and its law firm that had served them diligently for years. That would be a terrible precedent. It's not at all in the interests of Alaska Native communities who need skilled and dedicated legal advisors. Your Honor, this was pled as a $6 million case. The court should not permit this massive expansion of damages by KIC. based on a default proceeding. Your Honor, the defendants ask you to not write a blank check. Don't give it to them, Your Honor. Look at the evidence. Look at the expert affidavits and understand that KIC was not harmed and does not need to be compensated, even accepting the well-pleaded allegations in the complaint. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you to everyone. So what we're going to do, 1 o'clock on Friday.
Your Honor,
yeah.
You had asked me specifically to address the double damages. Do you want 10 seconds on it?
I
can do it in 10 seconds.
Let's record this. 10 seconds. Go ahead.
The arbitration damages are about the 50% or the 49% that KIC took from Solston. Okay? The enterprise value is about the other 51%. They're not double damages. They're completely separate.
Sure. Okay. Thank you. All right. So I do want to thank both sides. Well, I guess we have more than both sides, but I want to thank you for everything that you submitted. I sometimes say, and I'll say it now, that, you know, the job that you all have is a hard one, and I respect everything that you have done, and I have to take the time to absorb it all, and I hope you recognize the effort that it is for me as well. It's something that I don't take lightly, and I very much appreciate, as I said at the very beginning, I think with Mr. Gilmore, you were on the screen at the time when I was talking, but I consider it, well, this job is a privilege for sure. But to be able to have practicing lawyers with your level of experience and your expertise is a privilege. And I think the parties that are in the gallery should appreciate the level of advocacy that the court has been able to see these days that we've been here, but also in the filings that I've been able to review. So it's been impressive, and I won't soon forget it because I can't. but I want to thank you all, and that includes folks that are in the gallery too. So 1 o'clock on Friday, and to keep expectations where they are, I'm working through these hearings, and I will be reviewing the record for these hearings and some of the citations that you've all made so that I can make sure that I'm appreciating what you've all argued. And you've definitely moved me on some things and caused me to think about some other things. And it's been very appreciated and necessary for me to get where I need to get to resolve the issue as it should be. So thank you. We'll be off record.